Show. Head On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Late than never. It's about 6 minutes past noon here on the East Coast in beautiful Washington, D.C., on the campus of the Grand Historia. We will be here for the next 2 days, just so you know. I'll be live until 3 p.m., and then Rick Smith, my colleague from Pennsylvania, will take over at 3 and go to a little bit before 6 o'clock. A special treat for everybody out there, just to let you know. Since my slot between 6 and 9 p.m. will be otherwise vacant this evening, tomorrow evening, and Wednesday, you're in for a treat. John Fox from Woy Woy, Australia, will be filling in that slot the next 3 nights. Enjoy it. Be nice to him. Give him lots of calls, lots of love, and make it engaging, and help John out along the way. Anxious, I mean raring, to get back behind the microphone. So be ready to go with that. Oh, no. All right. Well, we may be a little dodgy with the stream as we go, but we'll be okay. But anyway, enough babble. For heaven's sakes, enough babble. Let's get things going and underway. Even as I sit here, I have our first guest of the day before me, who patiently waited for me to babble an intro to the program. Rob Biko Baker is with us. He has come to the America's Future Now conference from the League of Young Voters Education. He's the executive director. Hails from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and has. Well, you've energized a lot of young folks to get into the process, haven't you, Rob?
Yeah, I've spent the last 5 years making sure that young people are engaged and part of the process, because oftentimes they're on the sidelines, and during these important and sort of critical times, we can't do that anymore.
Now, I've heard it said that the election of President Obama was largely fueled by young voters. Is that your experience?
I do think the election of Barack Obama was fueled by young voters. I think he wouldn't have gotten in office if it weren't for young people all across the country turning out. But I'd like to say that the election of Barack Obama wasn't about Barack Obama. It was about literally about change in our community. And I think oftentimes people in the administration forget that, and so do pundits, media pundits.
Well, I was about to go precisely there, Rob. To the extent that you deal with young voters, are they happy with the way things are working so far?
You know, I think young people aren't dogmatic. I mean, I think you see what you've seen with the tea baggers, the tea party.
That's okay. We say tea baggers too.
Tea baggers. Okay, I wanted to make sure you said cussing and discussing in the intro. So
bingo.
You know, I think we're not dogmatic, we're not overzealous. I think we realize that our country was in a huge mess before he got into the office. And I think we're ready to have a frank and honest conversation with the administration, the White House, and we're going to push him. I think we got a lot of work to do. And, you know, I know that he said we got to hold him accountable, and that's what we're going to do as a generation.
In terms of that accountability, and in terms of the pushing that you see needing doing, obviously this is an off election year. The midterms are coming up in November. Still some primaries yet to be decided. Many of them already have been. And you know, to talk generally about any group is to inherently engage in a flawed discussion to a certain extent. But is there an issue that drives young voters more than, say, some other voting bloc?
I think jobs and then climate. I mean, I'm a new father. I'm 32 years old. I have a 2-month-old, and when I'm seeing what's happening in the Gulf Coast, it's scaring me, especially when you hear folks from both sides of the aisle saying that we want to continue with things like offshore drilling, and we've talked about nuclear power. You know, for me, how could we have a future when we're destroying our environment at incredibly rapid rates? And I know that there are a lot of young people at this conference that are passionate about that, and jobs as well.
Well, jobs is certainly a necessity, but also I'm glad you note that the environment is a part of it, too, because we all got to live here.
That's right.
And to see what's going on in the Gulf is particularly harrowing. Help yourself, by the way, to an I Love Mountains button.
Okay.
I come from West Virginia, and we've got the other end of the sleazy fossil fuel spectrum going on in Appalachia. I don't know if you know about it. 500 mountains a day, or 500 mountains have been blown up. 2,000 miles of streams buried, all for little seams of coal no more than 6 inches thick. So it's the same thing. It's the filthy energy fuel, and we absolutely do have to do something about it. Is there a particular strategy, Rob, for how you get people excited, how you bring them into the process? Because traditionally, the conventional wisdom has been, well, you know, you'll never get the young people in. You know, they're busy, they're scatterbrained. You know, they've got their whole lives ahead of them. How are you ever going to get them interested and keep them interested? What has been your success?
Yeah, I think there's two things that we look to. One is art and culture. Regardless of where you're from, what background, ethnicity, gender, most of us are moved emotionally. And we in our network, we have a lot of spoken word artists, hip-hop artists, R&B artists who use their creativity to get people engaged. And the other thing is online activism. I mean, what we're seeing with Facebook and Twitter, I know a lot of folks don't give it a lot of credibility, a lot of credence, but with these tools, we've been able to sort of flatten the media space and been able to control our message in a way that other generations have never been able to do. And, you know, we had nothing is less exciting than the census. And in the last 3 or 4 months, we've had over 20,000 downloads of our census video. So we're doing something right, and I think that this generation is going to keep pushing.
I certainly hope you're right. Do you see one area of the country as being more easily activated than another?
Well, we work all across the country, and I'll tell you, one of the toughest areas that I've seen is where you're from, is the Appalachian areas. I know that we've worked at Highlander and Whitesburg, Kentucky, and I've traveled through Appalachian. I've seen mountains that are not there, and I know that the economy is based upon this sort of destruction of the earth. And you know, folks need their jobs, and their folks, their grandparents, their parents have worked at these places. And you know, if we can get working class white folks, you know, to turn out and stay turned out and stay talking, my good friend Van Jones, when he was in the White House, said if what he was doing would help poor white people more than were people of color. And I think this generation gets that, and I think we got to keep moving.
Well, I was particularly moved and energized a couple of years back when I heard Van say we've got to turn places like the Gulf Coast and Appalachia from sacrifice zones into sacred zones.
That's right.
And it does begin. It does begin with some kind of an economic model. And whether it be Appalachia or the Gulf Coast or the West Coast or wherever, I think you're very wise in tying the issues of climate and economy and jobs for young people together, because they're interconnected in a way that many people don't necessarily get their heads around. It's that green economy. It's the greening of America. It's the switch over to a green grid that's going to provide the jobs that your constituency, your clientele, your membership, those are going to be their good paying lifelong meaningful jobs going into the future. As you guys put pressure on the White House and on Congress, do you sense that there is a positive upswell of energy for getting this done?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at Barack Obama's administration, you see some of the smartest and brightest minds when it comes to climate and the economy. But the thing that scares me is, you know, I'm watching CNN and James Carville was on there, and he was blasting Barack Obama and saying we need to do more for the Gulf Coast, and then he pivoted right back to that we need offshore drilling, you know. And I'm excited, but
doesn't that just make you want to run screaming around the room?
It frustrates the mess out of me because, you know, it's penny wise and dollar foolish. I know we don't have the energy capacity to sort of the capacity to switch over right away. But if we keep making that an option, we're never going to get there. We have to have an Apollo style project to keep pushing forward so we can come up with solutions.
Precisely. We will never have that capacity unless we begin to demand and build that capacity.
That's right.
Rob Baker, I tell you what, it's a real pleasure meeting you for the first time here. I hope we get to communicate some more in the future, maybe have you back on the show under a little more ordinary circumstances. What's happening in your world right now? What are you doing here at the conference?
I'm going to be on a panel at 2:30 talking about politics beyond the Beltway. You know, so many folks from D.C. think this is where the world is, and a lot of great stuff is going on here, but ordinary average Americans and every day are fighting to stay engaged, and that's what we're going to talk about.
Well, thank you very much, Rob. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bob.
And I look forward to us getting a chance to talk again soon.
Thank you, sir.
Oh, a website for what you do.
You can check us out at 99problems.org.
99problems.org, Facebook presence?
Facebook, and you can follow me at Twitter at Biko Baker.
Biko Baker.
B-I-K-O-B-A-K-E-R.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, and I wish you the best, and we'll talk soon, I hope.
Thanks, Bob.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that is Rob Biko Baker, a leader in the movement. Among other things, he is well recognized for his activism and with the League of Young Voters Education. L-Y-V-E, live. Among other things, he's shown up on Fox News and CNN, C-SPAN. Check out 99problems.org and see where it goes. We will be along with our next guest presently. That will be about 12:30. We will be talking to Greg Sindana. I love this this conference because it brings together so very many people of tremendous talent and ability. You'll be blown away by all the people you see later today. Tracy Van Slyke will be with us later. Jim Dean will be with us. John Bonifaz, Bob Borisage will join us at 2:30 p.m. to round out the show. Tomorrow we've got Scott Paul, John Gensler, Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks. I saw him last night, had a little conversation with him. Clyde Prestowitz will be here, John Atlas, and Angela Blackwell. Fascinating people all. Hey, Rick, you found your microphone yet? Let's see if I can find the button to your microphone. Did I find the button to your microphone?
Let's see.
I did.
Did you? Look at that.
I'm so thrilled. I don't know quite what to make of myself. How you feeling, buddy?
Oh, I'm feeling better than I did yesterday.
You've got the creeping grim death or something?
Yeah, this is part of the worst part of for better or for worse. For the last week and a half, my wife was miserably sick. And I stayed home, took care of her, and this is my just reward.
Oh God! So and you're on the front end of that curve.
I'm hoping I'm on the downside of this.
Cross your fingers. You called yesterday and we talked a minute, and you said how you feeling? Said like death. But you know what? You're a trooper. You stayed at it, and you're up, and you're here, and you are for those who are scoring at home. You are about 6 feet away from me, too.
That's a little too close, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, you know, I did everything but bring my bubble suit. Yeah.
As we should.
Now, this is you've been to this conference before. In fact, one of the first good sit-down confabs we had was last year at this conference. But this is the first time, like, doing a day's broadcast, right?
Yep, this is the first time broadcasting from here.
And just Lord knows that I pull your show like a little red wagon, trying to tell people about what you're doing. But just in case anyone's out there who has not who has not made themselves familiar with the Rick Smith Show, since we do have this opportunity to chat just a little bit, tell people a little bit about why you're doing this, what you're doing, and how and when, and all the pertinent details.
Well, so quite simply, we started the Rick Smith Show back about 5 years ago, because the area that I live in, very, very conservative area, much like your area. I mean, we're in the heart of conservatism where we're at, and we need voices that are going to add some balance. As you know, the airwaves today are dominated by conservative voices and failed conservative ideology, but they've got the money behind them to keep pushing their ideology. So we started the program. We've been fighting fighting the fight ever since, and it's been working. We're changing hearts and minds. You know, quick story. I used to get emails from this one guy, and I'll never forget him. First day on the air, he sends me an email with just you're an idiot. You're an expletive idiot.
What a nice way to get a relationship started.
You know, that's the way to go. And I wrote back, thank you, I appreciate your listening. We went down the road a couple of months. He would script my show afterward. He'd provide a nice outline for me, and after each point, you're an idiot. After about 6 months of doing a really great job of scripting my show for me, he wrote, you know, you made a good point, but you're still an idiot.
You scored one.
And ever since, he's been a loyal listener. We don't always agree, but it's having that conversation. And that's where I think we need to do what we need to be doing, is reaching out to people who have been listening to talk radio all these years and not really evaluating what they're hearing, but just kind of sitting back and bobbing their head going, yeah, that sounds reasonable, without bringing it through the filters of thought. Because if you listen to conservative talk radio, all their arguments are very nice, they're very easy, they're simplistic, down to the lowest common denominator. But they don't benefit people like you and me, Bob. They benefit the people who have big dollars. And Rush Limbaugh himself will tell you, he is the defender of corporate America. So you and I began.
Makes no bones about it.
No, and I tell people, he's honest. You got to give him credit for being honest. And, you know, they don't make him the $400 million man for no reason whatsoever. But folks like you and I, we have to reach out to people who listen to his program and say, this is the reason he's wrong for you. The people who fund him, he's doing their heavy lifting, Bob.
Yeah. Well, and a good friend of mine describes the people who follow him and listen to him as cannon fodder in the culture wars.
Good point.
And really, there, I don't know if you saw the news story that, it happened yesterday, because I left the studio screaming. The news story of his fourth traditional family values wedding.
I say he's a guy who loves marriage. His problem is he just can't stay married. He loves getting married. Loves it. Loves the institution. Loves it so much, he's done it four times.
Well, did you catch the fact that Elton John played at this gig?
I did.
The world has gone sideways, upside down, and fallen apart. But they did make a point in the news story, the coverage that I saw, Rick, of pointing out that Mr. John did not play for free.
Well, of course not. But I mean, stop and think about this for a second. You're talking about Rush Limbaugh, who's one of the biggest homophobes you could possibly imagine.
Well, if not a closet case himself.
Well, good point. But if you're Elton John, I don't care how much money you'd be paying me. I don't think I would do it just on the grounds of principle.
Yeah, in a way, it's kind of like doing Eminem's birthday party. I get it. But, you know, the thing that I tweeted yesterday, and it probably marks me as a very, very bad person, Rick. I tweeted, and I know you don't... I know you don't tweet yet. We're working with you on that.
Yeah.
But I tweeted yesterday, that the story of that wedding is proof that Al-Qaeda is no longer a threat in the United States. Because, you know, what an opportunity they missed. I mean, Karl Rove was there, Rush Limbaugh. You know, every last sleazy dreg of the creepy right wing came to watch Rush Limbaugh try it for the fourth time.
But I'm gonna I'm gonna make an argument with you here on
okay.
this. I don't think that would never be a target of Al Qaeda, because I think those people have actually helped Al Qaeda
right.
more than you could imagine.
Yeah, they're one great big, you know.
So why take them out?
Well, that's true too.
Send them a couple of bucks. You know, give them a wedding present. Maybe you know, a retainer for a divorce attorney.
Well, you know what? Rush had to do something, because there he was, living in 26,000 square feet with nothing but a cat. You know, I'm thinking the cat got tired.
Well, you know, like they say.
You know, you can only send the maid out for $40,000 worth of OxyContin, you know, so many times. You know, see, I think he's still on the junk. But, you know, that's because I'm mean and cruel. But if you listen to it, it sounds like the ravings of a junkie, which is kind of the thing. That's the whole thing with right-wing radio, most of it sounds like the ravings of a junkie. I saw something that came via that miserable, phony baloney libertarian Neil Bortz the other day, making a mockery of the 9 people who died in the Israeli raid on the flotilla. And it's just, is this what you people think is funny? You know, they can't. The only thing that passes for humor among the right wing is something that involves somebody dying.
Well, others. The others die.
Right.
Not you or I, not well, you or probably you and I, they'd be happy about. But, you know, not people that they consider them. Everybody else, yeah, it's humor. Everybody else, the others that they're so afraid of. And there's no class there. You know, I often wonder if their parents taught them any manners or respect at all. You know, you look at somebody like Limbaugh, you look at somebody like Bortz. They were LMVs when they were kids. And we all know the lunch money victims. You know, they were the kids who got beat up on the way to school.
Okay, no, I've learned a new one.
And got their lunch money taken away. We know that to be the case. And now they've got a platform to go back after those bullies and constantly poke them in the eye. I mean, that's really what it is. They've got this little man syndrome, this Napoleonic complex where they, you know, they've got to push themselves beyond.
You know, that's all so very true. And whether it's Limbaugh or Bortz or Beck, you know, Beck is out there now screaming about you're supposed to discriminate, trying to change the language and make people think that discrimination is a good thing.
Beck's a scary character to me, a very scary character, because there are people who almost in a cult-like fashion follow him, because he preaches that evangelical nonsense.
That Elmer Gantry garbage.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he scares me more than Limbaugh, because I truly believe Limbaugh believes what he says. When he tells you he's the defender of corporate America, he believes that. What he pushes, I think he believes. What Beck is pushing is some type of insanity that I don't think anybody should believe. He just scares me on a number
and
of levels.
But the ignorant do. And it's all predicated on keeping people.
I do love the chalkboard, though.
Delightful and stupid.
I love the chalkboard.
Well, you know, when we go to when the horn goes to full video, everybody gets a chalkboard.
I love that chalkboard. You know, going back to the old days of being in high school playing football. Seeing that
yeah, I'll see. Okay, yeah, the left guard's going to pull around. He's going to take out the end on the right. And yeah.
You know, when I played football, every play was a touchdown. Even if you're looking for that play 4th and inches, every play went all the way to the top of the chalkboard.
Yeah, well, I think it's just a sort of autonomic nervous reaction on the part of the guy with the chalk in his hand, and it goes. It'll work. This'll devastate him.
But then when you go to put his plans in, like some of the plays that some coaches I had drawn up, once you do that, that's the end of it.
Exactly. Well, our next guest has arrived, and I'm just, so let's, let me get the, yep, I'll take the cans away from you there, Rick. And pass them back over. Care for a pair of headphones? We're joined at this point by Gregory Sendana. Gregory Sendana is the president of the U.S. Student Association, among other things, according to his bio, which I am freely bogarting from. He's the first openly gay Asian American to serve as president of the U.S. Student Association. He comes to the U.S. Student Association via the Bruins of UCLA. He was student body vice president, campus organizing director for the University of California Student Association, gender and sexuality coordinator of Samahang Filipino, a Filipino advocacy organization. You have been very, very busy in a very, very short period of time, sir. And I have the wrong microphone. Okay, let's try again.
Yes, that's the case.
Wonderful. So are you a native Californian then?
Yeah, well, I was born in Guam, but I grew up most of my life in Sacramento, California.
Okay. We have a very dear friend and listener to the Horn who is from Sacramento and makes a lot of our programs a lot more interesting. Maybe that kind of activism is in the water out there. I don't know. Tell us a little bit about the U.S. Student Association, please.
Yeah, so the U.S. Student Association is the country's oldest and largest student organization. We currently represent more than 4.5 million students across the country, working on ensuring that educational access and affordability is expanded to all. Our kind of motto is education is a right, and we work with college and university students across the country to organize campaigns specifically on federal legislation, but we also support local and statewide issues as well.
Okay, and it's my understanding the DREAM Act is something that that your organization has been pushing very, very hard. Where does that stand, and what for people who don't know what it is, what is it?
Definitely. So the DREAM Act was first introduced in 2001. It's a piece of legislation that would essentially provide a pathway to legalization and citizenship for undocumented students who were brought here when they were young by their parents. So they know America as home. They went to school in America, elementary, middle school, high school. And it would basically, if they do, they fit a certain criteria and meet certain other criteria, including graduating from a high school here in the U.S., not having a criminal record, and some other criteria, they would essentially be able to qualify for conditional status and also qualify for federal financial aid.
What kind of an uphill climb does a child of undocumented immigrants face in trying to get into higher education?
Yeah, right now they don't qualify for financial aid, and a lot of states, they actually also have to pay out-of-state tuition, which we know is exponentially higher than in-state
Brutal.
Tuition.
Yes.
And so there's a lot of difficulty there, because also they can't have, because of the lack of documentation, they also aren't able to have certain jobs, a lot of jobs, actually. And so trying to...
Like student work study and so forth?
Yeah, student work study. So the two pieces of federal financial aid that they would be able to qualify for is loans and work study. And so all folks are saying is that they want to be able to work, and they want to take out loans, and they'll pay them back.
Yes.
To be able just to go to school.
Wow. In the context of the DREAM Act, it, as you noted, it has been previously introduced. Where does it stand? Well, there's a lot of stuff to sweat and worry about in this Congress because it's quickly coming to a close. What kind of weight does it have in as we move toward the end of this Congress and the end of the year?
Yeah, that's a great question. And so the last time that it was put up for a vote was in 2007, and now I think that there's a lot of different things compared to that moment and now. One, we actually have about similar amount of co-sponsors right now. There's a 38 Senate co-sponsors.
Wow,
which is a lot for any piece of legislation.
Well, for anything in the Senate.
Yes, and I don't know the specific number in the House, but I believe more than 140, 150 at this point. And what I think is different about this moment and where we're at now versus the last 10 years in which since the legislation was introduced is that there's been an emergence of immigrant youth and ally activists that have been really pushing the envelope and really pushing their respective senators and members of the House of Representatives to really say, this is really important. And I think it's also have been a part of a larger the larger immigration reform debate.
Well, I was going to ask you. You said there, you've got 38 members of the Senate. Am I being overly cynical when I assume that those are 38 Democrats or 37 Democrats and one independent in the form of Bernie Sanders from Vermont? Or
it's actually a bipartisan piece of legislation. It was actually introduced by Senator Durbin and Senator Lugar.
Oh, really?
Okay. So there's, it was not only even sponsored by a Republican, but it was authored by a Democrat and a Republican. A lot of folks see this as an important piece of legislation, not only to provide, you know, access to education for undocumented students, but also as a part of a larger economic solution to say we want these folks to work. We already invested billions of dollars in K-12 education. Why are we going to stop once they graduate from high school?
To what extent, you mentioned the overall immigration debate, to what extent does the toxicity of the weirdo right wing's apparent vile fixation with the immigration debate, to what extent does that spill over into legislation like this?
I think that that's been a difficult thing that we've been having to deal with as it relates to the larger immigration reform legislation. But I think what the exciting thing about the DREAM Act and the reason why it's been such a unifier is that so many people from across the spectrum, you know, different organizations, educational organizations, immigrant rights organizations, civil rights groups, a lot of folks have really put their support and weight behind the piece of legislation, and people do see it as a larger, not only, it's not just an immigration issue, it's an education issue, and it's also a strategy or an avenue to be able to actually help bring our economy back on track.
Do you have any idea of what kind of number, I mean, the undocumented status makes things, I imagine, more difficult than they would otherwise be. What kind of numbers are you dealing with in terms of people that we could add into so-called productive membership in this society?
Yeah, so there's a minimum of at least 65,000 undocumented high school seniors who graduate each year.
Wow.
A minimum. And you know, clearly because of the respective status, it's sometimes more difficult to be able to keep track of who's of those specific numbers, but there's at least an estimate of at least 65,000.
Amazing. And absent something like the DREAM Act, what happens to them?
That's a really great question. And part of the reason why even I got involved was to hear some of the struggles and stories that they face. Some folks actually have no other option. They try to find jobs like under the table jobs. They try to babysit or mow lawns until they're able to save up. But in this economy, in this time where all public institutions are increasing their fees at astronomical rates year after year after year, it's the thought of an education is becoming even further and further for a lot of these students.
That's an unfolding tragedy for the entirety of this nation. Greg, when students like this are unable to go and further their education, such as would happen with the DREAM Act, when they're unable to do that, What does that do, or do y'all have any numbers or any indications? What does that do to society as a whole? I mean, instead of having someone with a viable education, instead you've got someone, trying to job out of the Home Depot parking lot or doing the babysitting thing or whatever. Because, just to be clear, there's two separate classes here. There are the children of undocumented immigrants who were born in the United States and de facto are citizens. But we're talking here about students who are brought here maybe at 1 year old, 2 years old, 5 years old, who know this as home, and yet this country treats them as, well,
second-class citizens.
Well, but not even second-class because they're not citizens.
Yeah.
What kind of impact? I mean, we don't have nearly as much of a presence where I live in Appalachia as maybe you did in California. What does the culture look like when you start adding 65,000 basically young people with no hope into a society every year?
Yeah, that's a really great question, and I think
and it's a long one too. I'm sorry.
And that's totally okay. And I think it's something that we continue to struggle with because we. You know, for USSA, for myself personally, because I'm personally invested in this in addition to my role in working with USSA, it's something that we have to think back and forth each day about is what does this mean? And in my conversations with a lot of these youth who are actually would be directly affected, their response is, you know what, if they aren't going to do this on our behalf, then we need to force them to do this. And so it's part of it, some folks have you know, people are saying that they're losing hope, but I actually think that this has given them a reason to really come together, be stronger than ever, and like I mentioned to you before, kind of this resurgence of a immigrant youth movement that's really at the forefront of a lot of the conversations and the debate, especially when we're even talking about some of the recent incidents and legislation like in Arizona.
Oh, yeah.
SB 1070, and that's just that's the tip of the iceberg when it comes to even the other legislation that they passed afterwards as it relates to.
Well, and there are other states that think that's just the coolest legislation they've ever seen and can't wait to pass it themselves.
Exactly, and so it's been youth, it's been immigrant youth, it's been undocumented students, undocumented people that actually have been at the forefront of those fights and forefront of those battles, and so I think that they've been able to really take the frustration with the lack of inaction of Congress and actually say, We are a diverse community. We are a strong community, and together we're stronger. We're going to move forward, and we're going to push this to make it happen.
Everybody naturally assumes that we're talking mainly of about people of Latino or Hispanic origin, mm-hmm. but that's not necessarily the case, is it?
No, that's not the case. I mean, for myself, even as a Filipino and my who comes from a family of immigrants, there's a lot of communities who are directly affected by this, and it's not just Latinos, it's also the Asian American community, it's also the African American Black community, and I think that there's also been a new resurgence of leaders in those respective communities to show how diverse and just show how broad this issue impacts so many communities. And so that's also been a role that USSA has been able to play, is to show is to get the other education organizations to see how important this is, to be able to build the intersectionality of the different identities as part of the conversation and creating a narrative that makes sense and people can connect to.
Outside of the dream, well, one last question. What kind of feedback do you get from the administration as to where they stand as far as, are they willing to put some of their considerable weight behind getting it passed? Or are they just waiting for Congress to do whatever it is that Congress does?
So the Department of Education, Secretary Arne Duncan, President Obama, and candidate Obama, and when he was a U.S. Senator Obama as well, in those different levels, all have expressed support for the Federal Dream Act. They're not putting their full weight behind it right now, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of different political reasons why that may or may not be the case. But I think that you know, if comprehensive immigration reform does move into a piecemeal strategy and people think that that's the best way to go, that I think, you know, the DREAM Act is going to be an essential part of the foundation and groundwork to actually see that larger immigration reform happen.
And but that's, I should say that the DREAM Act is really not, it's not the be-all and end-all of USSA.
No, that's not.
Tell us a little bit more about the other work the organization does, please.
Yeah, definitely. So USSA was actually at the forefront of the recent legislation that passed called the Student Aid and Fiscal Responsibility Act, which mm-hmm. was actually coupled with the Healthcare Education Reconciliation Act, HSERA for short. And USSA was an integral part of organizing students and also other civil rights organizations, unions, to be able to back their support. And essentially what the legislation did was actually remove the middleman out of the transactions of loan distribution and origination, and because before, what they call it, the FEL program, the Federal Family Education Loan Program, mm-hmm. The Department of Education, basically subsidized lenders like Sallie Mae, banks like Citibank, to be able to do things that they can do themselves.
So profitize the process.
And it created a student loan industry. And we basically learned that we've been losing $10 billion. $10 billion. Not, that's not chump change either. $10 billion dollars of of taxpayers' money.
That's disappeared in Iraq money.
Every single year. And so this small shift of eliminating that middle person is going to, this piece of legislation is going to save us $68 billion in the next 10 years.
Wow.
And it was also a deficit-reducing bill. It also infused all of that money into higher education programs, which had been hit the most by the budget cuts, ironically enough.
So it worked hand in hand with the budgetary concept of PAYGO.
Exactly.
Wow.
And the reality, and you know, one thing that I like to share too is that it was that reason that we were able to actually move forward with the reconciliation process, because the whole point of reconciliation is to actually help reduce the federal deficit, right. And healthcare didn't do that, and we supported healthcare. Let's be very clear, and we're excited about the healthcare provisions.
Sure.
But we also know that it was because young people and students that organized to get student aid reform to be part of the reconciliation process, to even have the reconciliation process in the first place, that allowed for those victories to happen. And so we're really proud and excited about the work that students across the country have done to make that happen.
Do your efforts there speak to changing the dynamic between, because one of the things that I know became a function of that predatory student loan industry that arose was that we went from a country that did a lot of grants and a lot of work study to a minimization of that in favor of more debt slavery, more. Does that legislation affect that ratio?
So, where we actually wanted that money to go was actually to more Pell Grants.
Right.
A majority of that actually went to Pell Grants, because USAID is a strong believer that we actually want – our long-term goal actually is to have free education.
Yes.
Free education for everyone, you know, and really truly believe education is a right. And I'm trying to figure out in terms of your question the best response, but I think our idea is to try to eliminate as much debt as possible, and we think that if there is going to be lending at all, it should be lending that is efficient, that has low interest rates, and that ensures that
carefully regulated,
and
properly monitored,
and the best loans are direct loans that are directly funneled through the Department of Education.
Well, exactly, because that's the ultimate impact of student debt. Is that it takes brilliant, young, excited minds away from their dreams.
Mm.
Because if you come out of college and let's say you want to work with an NGO or do something that's got a heavily altruistic function to it. Well, if you've got a student loan burden that means you've got to be paying out $600-$700 a month just for your bachelor's, well, you can't go to work for that NGO. You've got to go to work for corporate America somewhere. Mm-hmm. You've got to go to work in some place that's going to let you service that debt, as opposed to what I think is far more important than that is following your dream.
Yep. And that's actually the frustration that we have, is that, you know, for USSA, we believe that we need to be infusing more money into, like you said, grant programs and whatnot. And even for myself, to kind of even give you the kind of picture of where things are at right now with education, and how the disinvestment from not only the federal level but also on a state level has really hurt. So I just graduated in 2008. I received a full Pell Grant. I received a full Cal Grant. I had work study. And I had Perkins Loan, which is the lowest interest rate loan in the federal government. I still, and also let me say, I worked 3 part-time jobs throughout my 4 years, right, in addition to the work-study job.
Right.
I still ended up with $40,000 in loan and credit card debt at the end of my 4 years at UCLA. And that's thinking that I have a Pell Grant, which is the most
need-based
grant.
How do you cope with something like that?
And that's something that I... it's been difficult, you know, and it's been interesting because, you know, I came to work for USSA after I graduated, which I'm clearly not doing it for the money, and I've had to try to find ways to defer as long as possible. And Sallie Mae keeps knocking on my door, and luckily I've been able to have lower payments each month than normal. I've been able to work that out with consolidation and with with the support of some with my parents. But it's been difficult because I know that not many people have had the kind of the opportunity or the,
right.
the privilege that I've had to be able to come work for USA in a job that provides some support with some loan repayment, or that it's not as high, which is still a weird. We're still weird to me to think that $40,000 isn't as high as other people who are leaving undergrad. That's not even. It's not,
right, right. We're not talking about going to
JDs or getting your PhD. This is undergrad with, you know, $100,000 in debt, and a lot of that even being private loans, which is mm-hmm. a whole other beast in of itself.
Yeah, 14, 15, 16% sometimes, sure.
18% is where Sallie Mae is at right now.
You're kidding.
18% for some of these private loans, the interest rate.
Well, it's predatory. It really is. Let me ask then. You know, with what you're doing with USSA, and looking at these financial issues, nobody ever wants to contemplate that they're not going to pay back their debt.
Hmm.
But student loan default is a reality in this country, and it is much more of a reality than probably most people even consider to the extent that they think about the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, of all the debtors in this country, student debtors are as much or more discriminated against legally and jurisprudentially in this country than anybody else, because by God, you can't bankrupt that student debt.
You can't.
Does USSA address these issues at all, or look into, you know, some sort of end to debt slavery?
Yeah. So there's many different ways in which we've been trying to approach that. One, there's actually a piece of legislation that was introduced that would actually allow student loans to actually be able to in terms of the bankruptcy piece that you talked about. But even bigger than that too, we've actually been working with other organizations around trying to also around the protection, the Consumer Financial Protection Agency, or there's different names for it, but creating mm-hmm. a body that would be able to actually oversee and help regulate the student loan industry. It's gone wild. They've been able to profit so much money, and now they are trying to find ways to hold on to that. And so we're looking to be able to figure out a way to better control that through some of the Wall Street reform and larger corporation reform.
Well, I am pleased. One of the things I like best about coming to work in this meeting is the organizations that I find out about that are doing great and good work around the country that I didn't know about before. And I add USSA to that list, Greg. Website?
Yeah, so our website is USstudents.org.
Okay.
And we also are on Twitter. If people want to follow us on Twitter, it's at USstudents, or you can even follow me at Gregory Cendana.
And that's Cendana?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, Greg, I really, really appreciate it. It's been a wonderful conversation. I look forward to seeing and hearing more about your efforts, and I wish you all the best of luck in the world, because I'm a little older than you, but you know what? I'm still working off the student debt.
Definitely,
being in your mid-40s and working off your student debt is a little bit scary.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much for the opportunity. We're looking forward to continuing our advocacy and our organizing, and appreciated the opportunity today.
Oh, it's a real pleasure. Do take care and enjoy the conference.
Thank you.
Bye now. Gregory Cendana from the USSA. That, of course, is the U.S. Student Association. USstudents.org. Go and have a look. Yeah, these are real issues. These are significant issues. Everything that Greg and I talked about, from the DREAM Act up to student financing, becomes an absolutely critical issue in how the country is itself shaped and what kind of a future the country itself has. Because if you've got a student population that is crippled coming out of the gate, you're going to be hard pressed. you're going to be very much hard-pressed to have a viable workforce going forward. So that pretty much takes care of just about the first hour of the program. You're Tracy? Okay. Well, sometimes you're right on time. That works out perfectly. Oh, bless your heart, because I was just checking the bios, and yes. Tracy Van Slyke is with us, and you kindly brought your materials, which
I did.
I really appreciate.
I'm here to serve.
You're an author.
I am.
You are the author of Beyond the Echo Chamber: Reshaping Politics Through Networked Progressive Media.
That is true.
And that's going to wind up. Well, I mean, that's a topic near and dear to my heart. So, let's do a little background real quick as to how you got from there to writing the book. What motivated you?
So I started out as a journalist 10 years ago, where I was covering local and county politics in Iowa, and then I was working for Knight Ridder in D.C., where I got to cover everything from the pandas coming from China to George Bush being appointed to president. And then I was the communications director at a national nonprofit focused on organizing, community organizing. Soon after, I became the publisher of a magazine called In These Times, which listeners...
Oh, I very much know it.
Yeah, yep. Was the publisher of In These Times for a couple of years, and now I am the director of an organization called the Media Consortium, which is a network of the major progressive media outlets in the country, ranging from, like, The Nation and Mother Jones to Alternet and Free Speech TV. And,
sure.
Yeah, all those people...
Okay, I know that organization. Y'all had a big meeting, up in New York City a couple of months back?
In February.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember reading some of the coverage about it on Alternet.
Oh.
I'm a fan.
I think it was an excerpt from the book, actually, that was part of it.
Yes. That's okay. Now
it all comes together?
Yes.
Okay.
I apologize.
Yeah, no.
A little behind the curve sometimes.
It's okay. This is why we talk. So, I run the Media Consortium. You know, around the same time the consortium was being born, when I was at In These Times, the executive editor of In These Times and I put together these maps documenting the infrastructure impact and funding of the right-wing media noise machine versus the lack thereof on the progressive media side.
So you start with the premise that we ain't got one.
Well, in 2005, we were starting with the premise... No, look at all the gaps,
and
here's what's not working. And then we did an update in 2006 to show what had already in a year had started changing on the progressive media side. And we were seeing and arguing from the very beginning that we didn't want the same infrastructure as the right, the sort of top-down, vertical,
marching orders,
authoritarian. Yes, exactly, talking points. We knew progressives were... too supportive of debate and diversity. Debate sometimes too much, but we don't want to coordinate talking points. What we want to do is support journalism, support quality analysis and messages, and figure out the right infrastructure to drive them out.
Right.
So in the book, we talk about how we obviously go beyond the echo chamber and move and create a networked powered media system that involves everyday people and independent media to work with each other and create and drive those stories out in the mainstream.
Do you think, first of all, is it coming together with as much speed as you would like for it to come together, based on your observations?
Well, I am conflicted. I think sometimes it's amazing how fast and rapid things are changing, especially with changing technology. And other times I was like, why can't we move faster? But if you look at just the changes that have happened in the last 5 or 6 years when we started just those maps and to where what we documented in the books, the how progressive media has really harnessed this new media environment, working with each other and working with their audiences and their community to make an impact on our politics. It's pretty powerful stuff.
Well, it absolutely is, and very much so. I'm looking at the your fact sheet here and what you've said so far. You know, you've mentioned things like In These Times, The Nation, mm-hmm. Mother Jones, Grit, the Alternate, mm-hmm. Blogs and so forth. How do we integrate that? Integrate all of those varied and disparate structures into, while we don't want an echo chamber, what do we want out of all of those institutions?
We want, first of all, one of the fundamental things that the consortium does and that the Netroots as well has done together is they've built the actual relationships. Like, people didn't actually really know each other that well before. And for any sort of partnership or collaboration, you need those actual one-on-one personal relationships with each other. So that when the time is right, when coordination is needed in terms of editorial coordination, say, everyone says, okay, look, we're going to focus on the environment for a year.
Sure.
For example, Mother Jones is working with Grist and Slate and Tree
right.
Hugger to actually cover the environment from many different angles. It's not all one message. It's all covering from multiple angles, but together, working together and with their community to drive that story out in a whole new way. So I think it's about collaboration, organizing, coordination versus ownership that we see on the right, consolidation and lockstep.
Yeah, monolithic.
Exactly.
Monolithic messaging. That,
yeah.
Go ahead.
At the same time, I think the right, while it was way behind in the
catching
left,
up on the internet.
Way behind in the internet in terms of those relationships. I don't think the blogs, or the right-wing blogs, have advanced as much, but what we see about how the right-wing is starting to take advantage of new media, Twitter and Facebook, especially around Tea Party movement,
mm-hmm.
It's
my
scary.
They can tweet
yeah,
some crazy
yeah,
stuff, can't
yeah,
they?
They can. And the thing is in the book we lay out sort of four layers of networks that media organizations need to think about how to operate in online, how to work with individuals and organize groups and so forth. And literally, I feel like the right wing has like taken that playbook and put it into action. So
is that a little frustrating?
Little. So I mean, like the great thing about in the book we really document between 2004 and 2008. All these great stories that I think are lessons still relevant today. But what still needs to happen is that we need to continue to invest in experimentation and innovation and new ways of using these tools and working with our communities. I mean, we can't sit back on our heels. It's not just about the politics. It's how we convey the information with our community and expand that community.
Well, as I read the excerpt on Alternate back in February, I had one of those, those little moments where you're just, yes, them, they got it, they figured it, yes.
Good.
Given the nature of liberals and progressives, mm-hmm. and as one, I don't mind being A, criticized or criticizing my own, we're a little like herding cats across the parking lot.
I never said that, did I?
No, I did.
Okay.
But with that, are we inherently going uphill with one foot in a bucket as far as the other side's concerned because they are in fact so good at being authoritarian and they are so good at all that top down stuff?
No, I mean, I think we're making a lot of progress. I mean, the areas that I think we need to continue to improve on is one of my favorite chapter titles in the book is called Go Beyond Pale, Male, and Stale, which we shortened to, I didn't ever say you were stale, but we often shorten shortened that to Beyond Pale and Male, or Beyond PMS, which both things are very painful. And we really do believe that diversity is key. Both within the structures we're creating, the systems, the people we're reporting on, and the people that are part of our media ecosystem, and that while the right is really fantastic at being authoritarian and fear mongering,
oh yes, they do have that one, don't they?
We have if we have the power of laughter. In a way that we need to think about how to really start integrating more with pop culture and laughter.
Yeah, witness the failure of Fox's attempt at a funny
show. Yeah, I don't think they do a very good job at that one. So, I mean, like, we need to find the counterbalance that emotionally connects with people. So it's about conveying information, but doing it also in a way that's entertaining, but not dumbing down. And we also need to continue to use these new environments. I mean, it's an old statistic, but how Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert, which is really is educating and informing a young audience because they're tuning in to laugh,
right.
But they don't like sort of realize what they're hearing about is actually news, and they're processing that information. So, I mean, that's just something that we have to think about.
It's the broccoli hidden behind the bite of pudding for the baby that won't eat his vegetables.
Yeah, I mean, we need to continue the way we're engaging in citizen journalism and working with our community to find and create news. We need to continue to build on community engagement, move in diversity, encourage people to create their own media, work with them, and also make people laugh.
I actually recognize about 99% of that in what we attempt to do with the horn.
That's wonderful. That's perfect.
Because you've got to be able to be serious, but at the same time you can't walk away from whatever you're doing every night. You know, just going to look for a warm bath to open. No. You can't do it, because from our perspective, there's a lot of, from our philosophical side of things, there's a lot wrong in the world today, and there's a lot that needs fixing. But we can't fix them all at one time, and there are some that we may not fix at all, but we have to make the attempt, but we also have to do it in such good spirit or in such goodwill, good faith, that we recognize that it's got somewhere along the way, the great old Southern comedian Jerry Clower said, you know, somebody up there getting some relief. You know, somebody's got to get some relief once in a while.
Yeah.
The other struggle, as I understand it, is that... whether it be blogs, and I mean, I'm not naming names or being critical, but you know, Alternet is out there fundraising, mm-hmm. Truth Out is out there fundraising, mm-hmm. God knows the Horn is listener supported. The seeming eternal struggle for bare survival.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? Is there some way of getting through? I keep hearing about the right wing can't open its mouth. Bill O'Reilly can't do a show without talking about George Soros. And there's all these rich liberals out there that we hear about from the right wing who aren't, if we're working on my side of the street, aren't really there.
Mm-hmm.
How do we build a model of financial sustainability,
mm-hmm.
for organizations that are building and maintaining these messages?
Yeah, so there's sort of a bit of history here. Well, first, I want to say that I don't believe in the death of journalism. I'm over that conversation. Journalism is flourishing in a lot of different ways. It's the business models behind flourishing, behind journalism that are having a problem, that we're in major transition with that around. And things are going to shake out a little bit. I think, for anyone that knows me well, they know that I don't ever go in the kitchen. But so this analogy is a little off. But, you know, I believe it's sort of the business models we're going to see is sort of going to be a stew. There's going to be a base stock that everyone is sort of... tapping into, but then they're going to create sort of their own special recipe that's going to really personalize how they're going to bring money and support the journalism and media they do. And some of it's going to be listener support. We might be pushing for government support. We might be pushing for more foundational support, different ways of creating business models that may not be focusing, bringing in revenue based on our content, but based on another product we put out. There's lots of different ways it's going to work. But in terms of foundations and the liberal donors, yeah, I mean, historically, they haven't had... They look at media and they think of it as a black hole, right? They don't understand the impact.
It's like buying a boat. It's a hole in the water you throw your money
in. Yeah, I mean, that's what they think.
Yeah.
But I mean, which is part of the reason that drove us to write Beyond the Echo Chamber, because we really wanted to document... the impact.
That it's viable and it makes a difference. And
yeah, I mean, we talk about how, you know, the impact of Brave New Films. Mm-hmm. And
Bob Greenwald's done just magnificent
amazing work. You know, do you remember when during the election and McCain was asked by a Politico reporter, how many houses do you own? Do you know where that story came from?
No.
Actually, Brave New Films had put out a short video documenting all the houses that McCain owned and how much they cost, interspersed with the story of a woman that lost her house.
I saw that.
Yeah.
Yes.
So
that was the genesis of that?
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. So and then the Politico reporter actually then asked McCain the question, which completely, like, I don't know if McCain would ever have won, but it changed the tone of the elections in showing that how out of touch with the economy that John McCain was. I mean, that's just one example.
That was that George Bush moment where he didn't know what a scanner was.
Yeah, I mean, like,
for those of us who remember.
I hope we all know how many houses we own or apartments we rent or whatever, or don't own. So that was, like, that's just one small example. We also talk in the book about how Talking Points memo blew the roof off the U.S. Attorney General scandal, how they actually worked with their audiences to connect the dots about what was happening around the country in a story the mainstream media was missing. Because of the work of their users, they were able to show that, investigate the story, connect the dots, and a year later, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez had to resign.
Right. And, of course, I don't know if it's in the book or not, but the other thing that it strikes me that our side has done such a magnificent job of is calling out the faults and inherent flaws in video game voting, you know, whether it be ESNS or Diebold or Sequoia or any of those other.
Yeah.
That's a story that the phrase I use, Tracy,
mm-hmm.
is the for-profit media.
Mm-hmm.
Because just like you said, it's not that journalism's dying; it's that the model is.
Exactly.
And so it's that profit-driven angle. Where everybody, I don't want to be Brian Williams. You know, I don't want a house on the Lower East Side or whatever. Well, I don't mind New York.
Right? No, I don't either.
But
I'm Chicago.
I don't necessarily need that. I want to do the best job that I can.
Absolutely.
Do. And make it quality and make a difference in somebody's life.
Sure.
And so, but you know, it's that notion that you've got to pay somebody out there, you know, $30 million a year. Rush Limbaugh gets $40 million a year, and until recently lived alone in a 26,000 square foot mansion with
a cat.
But
now he just got married, so
right.
It'll be more full.
God bless him.
Yes.
He does love traditional
marriage. Yes,
he
does.
But as we
he just likes traditional marriage, just a bunch of them in a row.
Right, with traditional family values,
right.
Prenups.
Right, exactly.
Right, exactly.
Okay, anyways, go on.
But anyway, to go wherever it was I was going a minute ago, that model where the for-profit media dictates what will be our reality. I'm hoping that we're slowly killing that, because, like I said, with the electronic voting thing, the for-profit media never would have picked it up, and in fact they poo-pooed it as you know, conspiracy mm-hmm. theory, and if it were not for a dedicated few activists, especially on the liberal side, our dear friend Brad Friedman, it never would have come
Absolutely.
Up.
Absolutely.
And now we know that they're
right. I mean, I think that's you know, a great example of the power of progressive media, and that even more so how we work with our community, our audiences, to deliberately and strategically spread that story through new media technologies, through offline events, and how we strategically push that story, whether it's through and into the mainstream or bypass and get to the targeted audiences that we want to reach, is really what essentially this book is about in terms of both strategy and the stories that I think media makers, anyone interested in progressive media and activists can learn a lot from.
What let me ask you one last thing before
mm-hmm.
we go. What kind of impacts is there? This is all very new frontier stuff.
Absolutely.
But is there a frontier within a frontier? Is there a place that this is going next? Is there a tip of the spear kind of thing going on? What from that mapping you did in 2005 to 2010 in June in D.C. You know where it's gone. Do you know where it's going?
I think it's going to continue to be sort of this this grid work. That's going to be created. More networks are going to be created among media organizations that they're going to figure out how more quickly to work together on both business and journalism models. They're going to figure out when to come together, when it's right to come together around specific events and issues. I think we're going to see all these layering on top of each other. I'm trying to find the right visual. It's almost like this 3D grid I'm visualizing here. versus this like monolithic top-down structure.
Right,
that the Red has.
Or two-dimensional plane geometry
exactly.
versus a third dimension of lineality.
Yeah.
Under those circumstances, then now what we do with the horn, for instance. I don't work on terrestrial radio.
Mm-hmm.
We gave up.
Good.
Because, you know, we know what the ownership of terrestrial radio is. We know that right-wingers are never going to let the right-wing ownership is never going to let our message onto what they perceive to be their airwaves, even though the airwaves are, by definition, public.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about going forward with that three-dimensional model, Is everything tied to where the internet goes next, or is it a matter of where journalism and creativity want to go next?
I would go with the latter. I think the internet's going to be huge, but I also believe mobile is going to be mobile phones, mobile video is all going to be the next generation as well. And I think where the delivery of journalism goes really depends on how audiences are going to be accessing information and where. So, for example, you know, that's why media policy is so important and net neutrality and broadband for all, because if we're going to support journalism and support as many people accessing it online or through their mobile phone or what have you, that's the literal infrastructure that we need to make that happen. It's about our democracy. So it's going to be creativity. It's going to be the literal pipelines that we're going to be building. And I think part of it's going to be the internet as well.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation.
Good.
I've got to get my hands on the book so I can see all
it's
of
in, it. It's for sale in the other room.
Really? Oh. I didn't know there was. See,
you haven't even left Radio Row
no,
yet.
No, I'm a galley slave. I'm just stroke. But I will get my hands on it because
great.
I think this is at least for what I do and what we do at the Horn. This is like a law school horn book or something.
Oh, good. That's what we were hoping for.
Well, Tracy Van Slyke, thank you very,
so
very much.
Thanks for having me.
I hope we get to chat again in the future.
We will.
And I assume somewhere along the way you will be updating this work.
Yeah, I mean, you can go to beyondtheecho.net to see a lot of the articles we're saving talking about the future of journalism, and you can always go to themediaconsortium.org to see how we're working with progressive media
that's
to raise out their impact as
that's
well.
That's another thing I got to figure out. What do I do to get
we
my
will
decoder,
talk about that offline.
To get my decoder written for the Media Consortium.
Awesome.
Take care, Tracy.
Thank you.
It's been a real pleasure.
You
an
too.
Absolute joy.
Thank you.
Tracy Van Slyke, co-author of Beyond the Echo Chamber. You know that this is a topic that is absolutely near and dear to me because how we message in the 21st century is going to have everything in the world to do with whether or not we continue to get our butts whipped. As we did for the first 20, 30 years that we ignored the rise of the right-wing echo chamber. Hey, Rick Smith. You got a microphone there.
Yes, I do.
Did you catch that conversation?
I did catch a lot of it, yes. Very, very interesting.
I thought absolutely fascinating insofar as, you know, it's one of the things that's most frustrating, and I know you and I have had this conversation on a number of occasions, is the number of people who don't get it. When you see folks like Tracy Van Slyke, and she does, then it's a real eye-opener.
Yeah, I've often said that Republicans understand empire. They understand that as we're on the Democratic side, on the left, everyone has their own little fiefdom. Everyone has their own little piece, their own little gig, whatever they're working on, and that's theirs. And they're very tight-fisted about that. And there doesn't seem to be enough working together to bring everybody under the same kind of an umbrella, where the right understands that you can differ on certain issues, but at the end of the day, they have a specific goal in mind. And they, like I said, they understand empire, and they're willing to, you know, you look at every area around this country, they have at least one local talker. One person who's local, one person who they support because they need
There's
that
There's one
constant.
Guy out there in Busted Knuckle, Nebraska who's...
That's how he makes his living.
Yep.
And then they fill the rest of the slate with crazy people from all around the country, but they always have that one local anchor that draws people to the stations. And one of the things that I found really frustrating about near where I live is you look at the Philadelphia market, for instance. Philadelphia has a massive, massive Democratic advantage.
So there's probably, what, 6, 7 liberal progressive talk stations in Philly?
Not one. But there are two conservative stations.
Well, look at the town we're in right now. This town wouldn't vote for a Republican president if God Almighty commanded it. And yet you can get all the Rush Limbaugh you want around here, all the Glenn Beck, all the Hannity job, all the that whole filthy crowd. You can have them in extremis in eternis.
But here's where they understand this. When I started my program, I'm in a very, very conservative area. People ask me, well, why do you want to do it here? This isn't where our members are. This isn't where our people are. But this is where the fight is. And what conservatives understand is if they can be in your ear, constantly, a constant drumbeat in your ear, and they can persuade you with their very, very simplistic message, always watered down to the lowest common denominator, they've got a shot. And they're going to fund areas like Philadelphia where they're so badly outmatched. They know they're never going to take over that city. They know it. They are never going to have an advantage there. But it's about the presence. And there are two conservative stations there. There's your mainstream ones with Limbaugh and Hannity and them. And then there's the true conservative station with the crazy people, the Huey Hewitts and the Borts and those people.
Yeah, the ones who speak to the real lunatic fringe.
Right. But there's
who make Beck and Hannity and Limbaugh sound sane.
But, you know, you talked about the Soroses of the world. You talked about the supposed liberal money out there. And, you know, the reality is, on the left, we don't have the big corporate interests. We don't have the big businesses. And they're the ones who make the money. If you can't get the big advertisers in this market, the way radio is set up, because, you know, as I've tried to explain to people, radio is a business. The guy who owns the station, he wants to make a profit. And that, for him, profit is advertising. If you can't draw in the advertising, you have a problem. Now, I mean, you know, what station, you know, you look at the conservative stations, are they going to take even a successful liberal program like yours or like mine or anybody, even if we could bring the money in and break their format? No. Yeah. So there's no incentive for them to do that. What has to happen, and I was never a big fan of the fairness doctrine until recently. And I'm kind of coming around to the idea that there's got to be something. There's got to be some intervention.
I believe there's got to be some intervention, but I haven't gotten to where you are with the fairness doctrine yet because I'm one of those adherents to the law of unintended consequences.
I'm not saying go back to the way it used to be where you had to tit for tat, because we both know that just ends political discussion altogether.
Yeah, because the idea of letting some conserva creep have mic time on the horn, shut it down first.
Good point, but at some point there's got to be something, and I don't know what yet. And I'm still trying to I'm wrestling with the idea.
Well, personally, Rick, I don't think it's a content issue so much as an ownership issue. You know, the reason they're not going to break that format is in the situation that you mentioned a minute ago. The reason that format's not going to get broken is because of the ownership, the media ownership. There's no liberal talk in Philly is because of the degree to which the right wing has been permitted to take lock, stock, and smoke and barrel ownership of all of the frequency band in Philly. These are people who will put up loss losers. A lot of the people who own radio stations do so to lose money. If you're Clear Channel and you've got one, you've got a station that's making money hand over fist, say WLW in Cincinnati, you know, 50,000 watt Clear Channel blowtorch, and literally covers the eastern side of the U.S. Well, you're going to need to own a few stations that are going to suck. Just to push
listeners to the other station.
Well, no, just to balance. You need stations that suck in Idaho, so that you can balance out massive profit machine that something like a 50,000 watt AM Clear Channel is. You know, look at other stations. You know. Stations in New York, stations in Chicago, whatever. Because the whole game, remember, because we're talking about right-wing corporatists here, the whole thing here is to make a lot of money and never pay taxes.
Good point.
And so if you break media ownership, first of all, the idea that one guy or one corporation or one company could own every radio station in, you know, a little small marketplace like, I don't know, Bowling Green, Kentucky, you know, where Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, comes from. The idea that all those stations could be owned by one, or the idea that the TV station, the radio station, and the local newspaper could all be owned by the same entity runs directly contrary to every concept of
competition.
Democracy or even market-based competition.
Yep.
You know, if you say I've got Bowling Green and you take Elizabethtown, you're not competing. What you're doing is you're creating these little media fiefdoms. So, you know, my thought on it is it's not so much a content-based restriction like the fairness doctrine that you need. We've got to have somebody go in and pull an AT&T on radio station ownership in this country.
Yeah, but we both know that's never going to happen.
I don't think. I don't necessarily agree.
I don't think that's going to happen. I mean, you look at the big gift that Bill Clinton gave them in '96. They're quite happy with the ownership.
And there you go. The Telecommunications Act of 1996, and that's what screws the pooch. It was bad enough. See, before 1996, Rick, it was our fault. It was liberals ignoring the importance of broadcast media, broadcast opinion media. We ignored it to our peril, and we got our answers handed to us. But after 1996, when we hand the very media structure of this entire nation over on a silver platter to the right wing, that one our side owns. You know, we became Daffy Duck. You know, you do not have to shoot me now. You may take me home and shoot me later.
Yeah, I the whole Limbaugh thing, all that right-wing talk movement kind of came under the radar. And everybody, I remember it. You know, everyone thought, yeah, he's a buffoon. I remember the guys that I worked with who used to listen to him. And I even started listening to him right at the beginning. He was a buffoon. I mean, his thought process was so far out of the mainstream.
But I remember liberals when I would say something to them, my liberal friends, and say, you know, we need to have somebody out there, because, you know, I come from a radio background. We need to have somebody out there doing the opposite of him. And I remember good liberal friends, you know, the ones who talk with their teeth clenched. Oh, no, we'd never want to be like him.
Yeah, nobody's listening to him.
We're better than that.
Yeah. And the problem is?
No, it ain't that we're better. It's that they ain't. And they're getting a message out there. And congratulations, you just lost another election. Wonder why that is. Yeah. Because how in God's name, Rick, does it... We've got a discussion started in this country as to whether or not the 14th Amendment that guarantees citizenship to anyone born in this country is appropriate to the 21st century.
And hey, we're the teabaggers on that. I mean, I got teabaggers who, we just need to uphold the Constitution. Last time I read my Constitution, that was in there. The 14th Amendment was firmly right there.
And that it, right, it, but and you're a constitutional purist, you know, a little teabagging purist.
But what's interesting is that the majority of the teabaggers that I've run across, and the ones that you can actually have a conversation with. You know, most of the time you have conversations with folks who disagree with you. It ends up with, well, you believe what you believe, and I believe what I believe, and they just walk away. But if you can really sit down and have a discussion, the reality is they really don't grasp the Constitution at all. And in most part, they haven't even read it. What they're doing is, like my good Catholic friends, and I grew up Catholic, who talk about the Bible. Catholics don't read the Bible. They read stories about the Bible. Look at Santorum. When Santorum was running for Senate, you know, he came out and said, look, I've never read the Bible, but I've read a lot of stories about it, a lot of articles.
Hoo-wee.
So I think it's the same.
I've never flown in space, but I've read a lot of Buck Rogers.
There you go. You know, I used to watch Buck Rogers in the 25th century with Aaron Gray. Tons of teenage. Anyway. but, yeah. I mean,
well, you remind me of one of my favorite pieces from The Onion. This thing has become one of those things that you come back to because it comes up again and again and again with whenever you talk about teabaggers. Look at this headline, Rick. Just look over here. Area man passionate defender of what he imagines Constitution to be.
There you go.
You know those guys?
I did not see that story. but I do know them.
Spurred by an administration he believes to be guilty of numerous transgressions, self-described American patriot Kyle Mortensen, 47, is a vehement defender of ideas he seems to think are enshrined in the U.S. Constitution and principles that brave men have fought and died for solely in his head.
Well,
welcome,
I mean,
to the Tea Party.
It's like the guy that I talked to who told me that we're talking about the Bible and religion, and you know, he's a big evangelical, and he told me, well, you know, Jesus said, you know, you teach a man to fish, you'll, you know.
No.
And I go, wait a second, hold on, let me remind, because I actually did read the Bible after I went to Catholic school. So after I recovered from Catholic school, I then did read it. And I said, you know, I think I did find that in the Bible. I did. Jesus was stumbling down the road to Jericho. There was nobody to give him any food. There was nobody to give him any water. He was naked as a jaybird. Nobody to give him clothes. He tripped. He fell. He tripped and fell, and he landed right next to Confucius, who was sitting there on the curb. Yeah, I remember this. It's right there in the Bible, right there, I'm telling you. And Confucius just said, you know, I could give you clothing, and I could give you water, and I could give you a fish, but I'd rather you learn how to do it yourself. So I'm not going to help you. Screw you. That's right there in the Bible. I'm telling you. It's right there, chapter and verse.
That's the 14th chapter of Flip-Floppians, verse 32, and Confucius says, screw you, Jesus.
But it's amazing.
And I thought I was the bad man here.
Oh, you know, look, I've got a serious problem with religion. I really organized, going to church type religion. Especially when you look at this thing that happened up in New Hampshire. Real quick story, if I can take a minute.
Oh, absolutely do.
There's this girl who, back in 1997, was repeatedly raped by one of the members of her congregation. And this is a 15-year-old girl. And the pastor, whose name is Phelps, no relation to the crazy, crazy people, Fred Phelps of the Insane Baptist Church out in Kansas.
Is he no relation? I read
no relation.
You're sure?
I'm about 90% sure. So makes this girl, this teenage girl, 15 years old, stand up in front of the congregation and apologize
for getting raped,
for being raped repeatedly and getting pregnant by some considerably older gentleman. I'm going to use a nice word there because if I go off on a rant here, I will lose my mind. But the girl, who the pastor says was, you know, not really responsible. The rapist was 99.9% responsible. But the girl had to stand up and apologize. And then they shipped her off to Colorado,
yep,
where she had the baby and she lived for several years. From 1997 till today, 13 years, that rapist, that scumbag, that piece of that the church protected walked freely on the streets of New Hampshire.
Yeah.
And in many states, he wouldn't be held accountable because the statute of limitations on most crimes is 2 or 5 years. Fortunately, in New Hampshire, it's 22 years after the 18th birthday on any sexual assault of a minor. So they're still this person's still going to go to prison. But in my opinion, 13 years too late.
And
my point is,
hanging and shooting's too good for him kind of thing.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. But my point is, the fact that this church protected this guy, that's not religion. That's not the religion that I was raised with. That's not the faith or the spirituality that I was raised with. That is an institution covering its behind. That's no better than corporate America. And in my opinion, many church groups have turned into that.
Oh, a long time ago. You know, I joking. Well, no, it's quite serious, really. I refer to myself on the air as a recovering Southern Baptist, and I am. And I remember back in the mid-80s when the church, the little Southern Baptist church, about 2,000 members, but the church that I was raised in spent $20,000 to bring Ollie North to that church to tell them how to love Jesus better. And I remember being on the phone in an absolute screaming hissy fit with my parents. You know, Mom, tell them, hold my letter, do it. I quit. I'm not. Now, don't do that. Don't act in haste. Don't be rash. I said, I'm not acting rash. They're the ones acting rash. Some of that $20,000 is my lawn mowing money from 20 summers ago.
That's disgraceful.
And they're going to give that to Ollie North. That's rash. That's radical. That's outré. Nuts.
Well, I got to tell you, the $20,000 that they gave Ollie, in my opinion, is in no comparison to the situation with this.
Oh no, it's not. It's not the same thing at all.
Because this poor girl was raped repeatedly by this guy, and then what I think is
not
almost
just raped, impregnated,
and impregnated. But what I think is almost worse is the fact that she's got to stand up there in front of all of her family and friends and neighbors and the entire community and say and apologize like it was her fault.
Sorry, some scheduling stuff going on there. That's the nature of this radio row.
Well, it's the nature of having things, happen on the fly. You can't. It's hard to.
Oh, all of this is on the fly. This is so on the fly.
That's why I like doing remotes because you never know what's going to happen. But sometimes you get stuck in a hallway by yourself.
Yeah. Or, yeah, broom closet. Yeah, right. I'll never forget doing the. Oh, I know you came. You came here to D.C. for the Good Jobs, Green Jobs conference.
Yep.
A month or so ago. Well, I was here at the previous one, which was held in the howling teeth of brutal winter across the way at the Marriott Wardman Park, and I broadcast live one evening from there. And yeah, no kidding, they stuck me in a room as far from the conference as you could get. And it's the second night. I was like, no, that's not going to happen again. You know, you're not paying me to be here. I'm going to do this, but you know, no, I will not hide my light under a bushel. So yeah, I understand that completely.
That's the one good thing about this conference. I think that you could be more front and center, I think it's important that people know that this exists and they have the ability to come by and look at the different shows and you know, like yours, for instance. I don't know how many listeners you get from this kind of a thing, but I would have to assume that some of your listeners come from this type of an endeavor.
They do. And, well, everything that's ever happened on the horn's been word of mouth. So, yeah. Well, it's that new media structure that Tracy Van Slyke was talking about. I really do. I've got to get my hands on the book. because I have a feeling I'm gonna be needing it. Oh, it looks like Jim Dean is on his way. Oh, that's okay, Jim. Welcome to the program. So good to see you again, my friend.
Good to see you.
Always happy to be at this conference and any opportunity to talk with you about what's going on with Democracy for America and in your world in general is always welcome. We're joined, so I could do this formally. We're joined by Jim Dean, founder of Democracy for America, and among other, I didn't realize it, the largest political action committee in the country.
Well, it's the largest of its own kind. It was actually founded by my brother Howard,
right?
But we, you know, it's part of the way we do things. I mean, we have a million members. There are organizations that are great organizations that have a few more. But our whole thing is about on the ground activism. It's about advocacy. It's about meeting online, offline. It's what we call online organizing for offline action. it's really about making a difference in local communities and getting good people elected to office at every level.
You guys have a really, really good nose for what the coming issues of the moment are, and you work them brilliantly. We had a conversation this time last year about where you thought healthcare was going to go, and you were right. I don't think either of us were necessarily thrilled with the ultimate outcome.
Yeah. It wasn't the bill we wanted, but as I tell people, it was the vote we had to have.
Right.
Because at that point, that vote was about whether we were going to have an effective presidency for the next 3 years.
Exactly.
But listen, we'll have a chance next time around. We'll have a chance in 2011. I'm very optimistic. It won't be a health care bill, but I think expanding Medicare, allowing people to buy Medicare, cleaning up some of this insurance company language that's in the current bill, I think we'll have a chance to at least try to make this.
And some of the Medicaid
better.
Stuff is profoundly important.
Yes.
And sort of gets overlooked in the general rush. But if we get to a point where there's a complete end to the pernicious asset testing that was involved with state administration of Medicaid, that's going to open doors in places we never dreamed of them opening, places like Mississippi and Alabama, that I don't know that anything else could ever have opened for us.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, this did move the ball forward. I think the objections, at least in our community and probably other folks like us, were as much about the process as anything else. You know, at one point we had over 50 senators who were willing to vote for a public option, and that all got derailed because of 4 to 6 senators, one of whom is going to lose her primary for Senate tomorrow in Arkansas. You know, I think a lot of this had to do with the perception, of rightfully so, that many of these senators have been taking so much money from health insurance companies that was what was really driving their vote instead of what's right for the public. I mean, the folks in Nebraska, majority were for public option. Folks in Arkansas, majority were for public option.
Right. Well, look what just happened in Alabama.
Yep.
Arter Davis ran as hard as he could go to get away from Barack Obama and to get away from the health care bill, you know, didn't vote for it on the floor of the House, and campaigned like he was proud of that. And the guy who said, listen, I've been for health care reform all along, beat him, it wasn't even close, beat him mercilessly in that primary.
Well, that also gets to another part of that. I call it culture of activism versus culture of incumbency. You know, I mean, we have great incumbents in Congress because they behave like activists. We have others who give speeches like Blanche Lincoln gave, where she said she would vote for the health care bill and then she would join and filibuster with the Republicans against it.
Yes.
We don't want that anymore. Folks are fed up with that stuff. They want somebody who's going to be true to what they are. They may not agree with that person, but they want to see some conviction and reality. And when you're someone like Cree Deeds or Arthur Davis and decide that it's time to tack right, left, left, right, center, instead of trying to have conviction about what you're really for, that's the recipe for disaster, and that's what happened in Virginia, and that's what happened to Arthur Davis in Alabama.
Well, if we, I think you and I both agree that putting Blanche Lincoln out to pasture in favor of Bill Halter, if something like that actually happens, will that maybe calm some of this idiotic this idiotic business about how powerful the teabagging movement is, and will it show that progressives and liberals are actually the people who can really affect the real sea change in the American political climate?
Well, I think it will. I think it already has. But I think what's also happened is, and I'm hopefully this is going to happen, is party leadership at the higher levels is going to understand that this isn't about making yourself sound ideologically okay with everybody, which is impossible. What this is about is being a real elected official who is responsive to the public and not responsive just to lobbyists and big business groups in Washington. And that is a problem. You know, it's not progressives aren't the only people that have problems with that. The teabaggers have problems with the same thing. You know, they don't want somebody who's being funded by the banks any more than progressives do. Teabaggers don't want somebody who's being funded by health insurance companies any more than progressives do. And that's the perception that's out there. And I think that's a lot of what this race is about. It's not an ideological battle. It's, again, about that activist versus incumbency. And I hope that this is going to send a message that campaign finance reform is something that's important and that people who come to Congress are expected to operate out of conviction and not out of who gave them the highest contribution.
Will we, and I guess if anybody has the right to say yay or nay on this, if Blanche Lincoln is gone by close of business tomorrow, will we take that out there as a Democracy for America, you know, sort of a let it be known this can happen to you, sort of warning to wishy-washy Democrats, corporate Democrats everywhere?
I think that's a fair statement, yes. We certainly will be doing that. There are some of those who are still going to be in Congress, and particularly in the Senate. They're going to be some of them are up for re-election in 2012. But I think more importantly, because, of course, you know, we have so many issues and so many challenges right now that we've got to deal with, what I'm hoping is that it's going to make for more effective campaign finance reform legislation, financial reform legislation. You know, all of these things have been watered down in this culture where they say, well, look, let's just pass something, call it reform, and even if it doesn't do anything,
right,
everybody will be happy. I think what I'm hopeful for is that a Halter victory, or even the fact that he's made such a great race out of this already, is going to send a message that we're really serious, and everybody is serious about reform, not just progressives, not just liberals, but everybody.
And does it send a message in terms of our ability to counter the impact of Citizens United money sort of limitlessly being poured into the political process?
Well, I think you've seen that reaction, and this is very positive. I feel very good about some of the things that are out there. You know, there's a fair elections bill in Congress right now. That's got 150 sponsors, and it provides for financing for congressional campaigns so that people don't have to be beholden to corporate lobbying interests. We've got another bill that's out there that's going to make corporations disclose much more transparently, actually, than they have even before Citizens United, the kind of money that they spend not only on lobbying, but also on these issues that issue advertising.
Is that the one that was co-sponsored, Charles Schumer?
Yes.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. A victory such as Bill Halter's tomorrow makes it so that it is much harder for people in Congress to water bills like this down. And that's the real problem that's going on now. You know, you say, hey, we need climate change, and then you get this bill that doesn't do anything at all. What really I'm hoping is this Halter victory tomorrow would really make people understand that they're being watched, and that they're looking for real meaningful legislation. They don't want something papered over, and they're not going to stand for, you know, a banking favorable amendment stuck in there at the 11th hour that nobody supposedly will hear about. And that's the kind of stuff that really drives people nuts.
And you mentioned an environmental bill. Is that where we go next, do you think? I mean, is that the next big ticket on the agenda? Some sort of climate change bill?
Well, certainly the BP thing, and we're actually involved with that now. We're doing a boycott of BP that we're doing with Huffington Post and filmmaker Michael Moore. And the whole idea is not only just to stop buying your gas from them, but also to get the local Democratic Party and local municipal governments to stop investing and otherwise putting their money into these things. And, you know, because of BP, it looks like climate change is sort of the next thing, big thing. But the fact is, a little of this is opportunity driven. We can't control the calendar of Congress.
No, of course not.
And we've got to be
able.
And
you're running out of Congress too.
Yeah,
I mean, this all
we're running out of time. And,
yeah.
And you know, we do have this fair elections bill that's in there. We've got the climate change bill that's in there. We have still have some financial regulatory reform stuff that's in there. So there's an immigration. You know, there's a lot of challenges out there. And
not
a little
without
bit is us trying to pick our spots to find out.
Is this a walk and chew gum moment for the Democratic Party?
I think it's going to be a walk and chew gum moment for 8 years for this presidency, and that. And it's not because of, and again, what we're trying to do is make it easier for that to happen by not having it gummed up, if you will, by the whole lobbying factor, because there are so many challenges, you know, and people keep forgetting, and unfortunately the mainstream media keeps not mentioning the fact that, you know, we got a huge hole to dig out from that was created and dug by 8 years of awful, awful government. And that means we're going to be dealing with a lot of different stuff at the same time for a while.
And well, and so yeah, tell our good progressive and liberal allies in Congress to, you know, don't wear the good shoes to work. Show up in your tennis shoes. You're going to be on your feet for a while.
You know, that's true,
Jim. I wanted to hand you one of these.
Well, thank you.
I work. Headquartered. The Horn is headquartered in Appalachia, and we're on the other end of the BP nightmare. To the extent that the Gulf gets the oil, Appalachia gets the hell and damnation that accompanies the relentless pursuit of coal.
Yep.
So thanks for putting on the I Love Mountains button. I really appreciate it, because when you mentioned an environmental bill a few minutes ago, you know, the fact of the matter is it is absolutely, for those of us who are activists in Appalachia, it is crazy making that we would have an environmental bill that has literally billions of dollars of corporate welfare for the coal industry.
Yep.
Built in. And yet at the same time, that same coal industry says, what was it? It was the day after President Obama delivered the eulogy for the Upper Big Branch miners.
Yep.
In which he actually repeated, for the nation and the world, he actually repeated the marketing slogan of the West Virginia Coal Association for them. Yeah, and they'll be using it forevermore in ads. You know how they are.
Yep.
Coal keeps the lights on. They can't buy that kind of PR. The next morning, the head of the National Mining Association came out and said, Barack Obama has parked his tanks on our lawn.
Yeah.
As liberals, I one of the things that I've been trying to do lately is to sort of tie the BP thing in the Gulf and the coal thing in Appalachia and strip mining all over this country into a very, you wouldn't say tidy, but a toxic bow, because it's the same thing as the relentless pursuit of the filthiest possible energy form on the planet.
Well, God bless you for that. And I'll tell you, there's one strain that comes through all of this, and maybe you've already been talking about this, and apologize if you have, but it really is, gets to the heart of what the biggest danger to capitalism and free enterprise is in this country, because it's not government regulation or government spending.
Itself.
It is the lack of accountability among our business leaders, the people that are supposed to be stewards of free enterprise and capitalism, the people like the folks that run Massey Energy and these other companies.
And see, that's the whole point.
That they want something for nothing, and that's what they're getting, and that is what we got to fight against. It's the same with BP and Exxon Valdez.
Yeah, we've been working so hard to point out to people the fact that while they don't, while they seem to be wildly different people, Tony Hayward of BP and Don Blankenship of Massey are the same guy.
Yep.
The fact that Tony Hayward knows which fork to use on the shrimp, while Don Blankenship throws a McDonald's Happy Meal at his maid.
Yep.
Really happened. No kidding.
No way. Really.
Really. Yeah. He was sued for it.
Wow.
He threw his McDonald's breakfast at his maid.
Jeepers.
Because she forgot, you know, she forgot to tell him to hold the pickles, hold the lettuce, or whatever.
Man,
but they're the same guy.
Yep,
and they're the same problem.
Yes,
and they are the same toxin injected regularly and routinely both into our politics and our future.
Yep, that's true. And then, you know, it gets back to why we're doing this Primaries Matters campaign right now. because there's too many politicians who are taking big money from these folks and voting the wrong way and hoping that their folks back home don't find out about it. And they're doing it for the wrong reasons. And, you know, we have this situation you want to talk about. You know, it's not just Appalachia. It's upstate New York with this Marcellus Shale drilling, the hydrofracking, the chemicals.
We've got Marcellus Shale in West Virginia,
right, exactly,
too.
Exactly. And the water quality issues that have already come up from this problem in Colorado and Nevada and Wyoming. And, you know, it's up to us. Barack Obama's election was the beginning and not the end. It's up to us to take control over this. There are very good businesses out there that pay their workers well, that do right. They're not perfect because no company ever is, but there's too many of them that don't, who believe that they're entitled to everything and owe everybody nothing. And that's the kind of person you have in Don Blankenship. It's the kind of person you have in Tony Hayward. It's the kind of folks that are running the big banks, which is why we're doing a Move Your Money campaign. It's the kind of folks you have at the industry leaders. We need to get a new set of companies in here. Paul Krugman was right, and we need new business leadership. And if you're going to have these technologies out there, you need people that are really going to be responsible for them, and we don't have that now.
Well, look at the beautiful day we have outside, you know, the warm sun. And how about that? We got warm sun at the same time that the wind's blowing, and somewhere in West Virginia right now, some fraction of the 3.5 million pounds of high explosives that are used every day are going off.
Yep.
When that right there can be our salvation.
Yeah.
I guess, Jim, the question is, how do we tell me a little bit about the Move Your Money campaign, because that sounds very, very important in the overall scheme of the consciousness that moves toward the wind, toward the solar, and away from the explosions on my mountains.
This is a campaign with Huffington Post and Michael Moore that we're doing, and really the idea is for folks to take their money out of these big banks and put them in financial institutions that are community-minded, for, you know, a more sustainable economy.
Yeah, community banks weren't the ones that got hammered in the bubble.
Credit unions. There are lots of institutions out there that are perfectly capable of doing this and managing it, but also that are more responsible to the communities that they serve. We don't have that in these big multinational corporations, and we never will.
No.
You're never going to have that kind of stuff. You'll have Goldman Sachs, who throws a bone to the United Way once a year, and we need to do better than that. And we need these companies need to be replaced. They're not going to just reform. We need to replace them with better institutions. And right now, that's what this Move Your Money campaign is about.
Yeah, one of the things that absolutely astonished me, Jim, was the fact that it turns out that one of the big greens that's so active out there, the Environmental Defense Fund, one of the members of their board is a hedge fund manager who is one of the single largest investors in Massey Energy. You know, we've got to sort some of that stuff out and have honest conversations about why that is and why we allow it to happen.
Well, the operative word is we. Us, not they, not the folks on the board of directors, us. And if we're doing that, then it's not a matter of if, it's only a matter of when. But at the minute we give up on this stuff and leave it to somebody else, then we're going to be in trouble.
Jim Dean, it is always a pleasure, my friend. Best of luck to you, and let us know anytime we can help.
Thanks, I appreciate it.
All right.
Keep doing what you're doing.
Thanks. Take care. Yes, absolutely. Please do. Jim Dean from Democracy for America. Styling mighty nice with that I Love Mountains button on, I got to say. That's looking pretty good there, Rick.
Yeah, I've had Jim on my program a couple of times.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, I enjoy having him on, yep. And the work that he does, extremely important. You know, one of the things that he said kind of caught my attention about the health care bill. You know, it's, in my opinion, this is a starting point.
Mm-hmm.
I would have liked to have started a couple feet closer to the finish line, but it's just a starting point. And I know a lot of people like me were angry by what we got, because I don't think this is near enough. But like anything, it's now you're in the ballpark. You know, now you've got a starting point. Now you got to move it forward, and you got to push. And hopefully, over the next couple of months, when people start seeing some of the benefits, because a lot of it goes into effect here in the next month or so, couple of months or so.
Right.
once they see that and they see the benefits from it, and you see that that government is working, you know, after all the years of government not working, that's one of those things that you know after years of seeing government not work, to finally see something positive might change some people's thoughts.
I think you're absolutely right, Rick. We will jump into our next conversation here. We are joined at the table by John Bonifaz. I'm Bob Kincaid.
Hi, Bob.
Pleasure to meet you.
Good to meet you.
You are the legal director of Voter Action and director of Free Speech for People.
Yes.
I am intrigued by both, but I must say probably more by the latter.
Yes.
Because you know, what you are engaged in is a campaign to restore the First Amendment and fair elections to the people. What direction does that take, if you please?
Well, it's really a response to the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in January of this year.
Citizens United.
Citizens
I suspected
United.
It was.
That's right, which basically unleashed billions and billions of corporate dollars into our elections now, which says corporations can be treated as people with free speech rights in the political sphere. And this ruling is the most extreme extension, Bob, of a 30-year erosion of the First Amendment, a corporate rights doctrine that's come in and taken over our First Amendment from the people.
It actually runs even, but in terms of that twisted notion of corporate personhood, it actually goes even further. Doesn't that go back to dictum in Union Pacific versus Santa Clara County or something like
does.
That?
It does. In 1886 case, you're absolutely right. It wasn't even in dicta. It was in the headnotes
right,
of the ruling.
Right.
But the reality is that, you know, most of where the corporate America focus now is with the Constitution is in the First Amendment. They're misusing, in our view, the First Amendment to strike down democratically enacted reforms in a host of areas.
How do you begin to attack a travesty like Citizens United? Because that thing was, first of all, I personally hold to the belief that. To the extent that Roberts and Alito voted in favor of that ruling, that they rendered their testimony in their confirmation hearings perjurious by virtue of what they said about Stare Decisis.
They certainly said, as Justice Roberts said, you know, we're supposed to be umpires.
Balls and strikes.
Balls and strikes.
Balls and strikes.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
But how do you begin to attack something like that from a constitutional framework standpoint?
Well, I think we've got to push back in the courts. There's no question on that. But ultimately, we have to say that we're going to reclaim our democracy and our First Amendment for the people via constitutional amendment process. You know, we've done this before, 27 times before in our nation's history.
Sure.
And we can do it a 28th time to make sure it's we the people who shall govern, not we the corporations. And that's got to be the leading response. There is, potential that down the road, a different makeup of the court might recognize the error of this. But this is like one of those prior egregious rulings of the Supreme Court that requires a constitutional
amendment.
Yeah,
you don't want to wait a generation for somebody to figure out Plessy was wrong.
Exactly. And this is a Dred Scott, Plessy v. Ferguson, Bush v. Gore type ruling, and we've got to respond to it in kind.
In so doing, I mean, is it just a matter of clearly stating corporations are not people, or that corporations do not enjoy civil rights as understood and conveyed unto, you know, born citizens? What are the mechanics of it?
Well, that's essentially it. I mean, the actual drafting might be slightly different in terms of the wording. We've got a proposed draft on our website at freespeechforpeople.org. But basically the idea is that Congress and the states shall be able to regulate corporate spending, period. I mean, corporations are not people. They're not like you and me. They don't have human qualities like you and me.
Among other things, they're immortal.
Well, they're immortal. They have state-based advantages like that that we don't have. They have limited liability. They have perpetual life. They have the ability to aggregate wealth and distribute wealth. And
right.
So when we think of the top Fortune 100 corporations in our country, these mega corporations, I mean, they made, $600 billion in profits, Bob, in 2008 alone. If they had spent even 2% of those profits in the 2008 election, as this ruling now allows them to do for future cycles, they would have more than doubled all the amount of money spent by the presidential
It's suffocating, isn't it?
Exactly. I mean, you know, we had a problem before this ruling of money in politics, but this is a landscape change that requires us to stand up and respond to really reclaim our democracy.
What does What is the ability, and I want to get this right, because one of the things that we contemplated when Citizens United first came out was that, you know, you just mentioned that 2% level and what a stunning amount of money that would be. The other side of the Citizens United coin was that, you know, they don't even have to spend that money though, really.
Right, exactly.
If they go and take out one guy.
Exactly.
And I mean, it's the horse's head in the bed, you know what I
mean?
Yes,
exactly. It's a psychological impact. There's no question that at the federal, state, local level, and even in these judicial races now in the 22 states where they have them, we're going to see the psychological impact of these corporations being able to exact a public policy in their direction against the public interest because of their ability to make the threat that they can come in and take you out, target you as a candidate for re-election. And that's really, or even for a challenger trying to go up against an incumbent who is in the pockets of corporate America. I mean, that's the danger that we face.
And one of the things that scares me the most, John, is the fact that while we talk about the pernicious potential influence, and I think we're already seeing some real-time influence from it as well, but while we talk about its pernicious potential influence, the one thing that gives me the cold sweats is the idea that there is a time frame involved with amending the Constitution that is almost glacial, and I wonder how much damage a corporation that enjoys having this kind of personhood, these kinds of rights, I wonder how much damage they can do in the time that it takes us. Well, you know, it's like that old saying that a lie goes around the roof, around the world before the truth has its shoes on.
Right, right. Well, you know, this is one of those instances where this court has issued a ruling that has widespread opposition across political persuasions. 80+% according to an ABC News Washington Post poll in February opposed this ruling across the political lines, Republicans, Democrats, independents. And I think that's what's different here, is that you have this unified opposition, and frankly, you see the threat already there. There have been instances where we have amended the Constitution in a short order. We changed the voting age from 21 down to 18 in a two-year time period. Mm-hmm. Certainly the 19th Amendment took decades guaranteeing women the right to vote. We need to go down this path. We can't say how long it will take, but I think there's a particular moment and opportunity here that requires us to seize it and to reclaim our Constitution.
Are those opening early steps being taken in Congress, John? I mean,
They're not only being taken in Congress, but they're being taken at the local level. So in Congress, Congresswoman Donna Edwards and Congressman John Conyers Jr. have come right out of the box with an amendment that would overturn the Citizens United ruling. They already have 25 co-sponsors on it. We featured it on our site at freespeechforpeople.org. But at the state level, and that's really where we have to build this broad-based movement, there's already organizing happening. In Massachusetts and Maine, we're going to see resolutions introduced in the state legislature calling on Congress to amend the Constitution to reclaim our democracy. And we can do that at the local level, too. People listening to your show can organize in their community to get resolutions passed calling on Congress to take this action.
Well, I certainly hope they do, and we on the Horn have been beating this like a little tin drum since it came out, because it's so odious, and it is so utter. It shows the decision itself shows such naked and utter contempt.
Yes.
For the entire democratic process and the entire concept of free speech. One of the things that I've said on a number of occasions is that we are fast approaching a time in the United States where if we do not do something significant and do it soon, the First Amendment will be reduced to little more than a life support system for the religion industry.
Right, right, exactly.
Because it seems that with very few exceptions, especially on the right wing side of things, the only time they ever bother to mention the First Amendment is if they want to talk about some televangelist's right to hustle the gullible.
Right.
As opposed to the vital national dialogue that the First Amendment was designed and envisioned to facilitate.
Right. I mean, the other part of the First Amendment that would stick around if we don't make this change is it will become a further tool for corporate America to get its way, to strike down democratic reforms. You know, and that's the point that we're really trying to make. The First Amendment was never intended to protect corporations. It was intended to protect people, and we need to restore that basic principle.
And the law of corporations itself says that corporations themselves were created as something to be of good to people.
Exactly.
Within their charters. I mean, early on they had to be defined that way, didn't they?
Exactly. And in fact, some of the organizing that we're seeing at the state level on this now is to change corporate charter laws at the state level to say that corporations in their states shall not be able to make political expenditures, if that's not what they're set up to do, and that they won't be able to have a charter if they start doing that. Now, you know, that's going to create a new test kind of case against this court, but I think we need that kind of resistance to demonstrate that it's we the people who rule, not we the corporations.
I think you're absolutely correct. The question I would ask, however, is whenever you hear someone talk about this, and especially on the other side of the aisle, say, well, you know, look at all the money the unions can spend. The unions don't have nearly the kind of financial sway that these corporate treasuries do they?
No, they are already outspent prior to this ruling far more than they have at all, and they will be exponentially more outspent as a result of this ruling. Unions, as we know, are set up to advocate and advance the interests of working people. They're not set up to aggregate wealth, to distribute wealth. That's not what they're about.
Right.
So they don't even have those kinds of resources at their disposal. But at the end of the day, you know, what we're talking about here is making it clear that the First Amendment is designed to protect people. And you know, unions are made up of people, and the people within those unions will still have free speech rights. But whether it's a union or a corporation or anything else, it's a state-based entity. It's not a human being. They don't have the rights under the First Amendment that are designed for you and I, we
the
people.
It's a completely different animal altogether. To say that there's, well, it's a false equivalence is what it is. It reminds me of the definition of an at-will employment agreement, you know, in which the employer is free to fire you for any reason or
right.
no reason, or you, employee, lucky you,
right.
are free to quit
yeah,
for
exactly.
any reason or
right.
no reason
right.
when
right.
you know, no one in their right mind would.
Right, exactly, exactly.
But you know, we see so much of that. Is there a particular ABCDE to how you hope to accomplish your goal, John?
I think we're going to really engage in the broad-based grassroots building level. I mean, that's what we have to be doing. We have to go to the communities all across this country, whether it's the BP oil spill, whether it's the Massey Energy and the 29 coal miner deaths in West Virginia, whether it's Vermont Yankee and the need to shut down nuclear power plant that's threatening people's basic health, or take it outside the environmental side, whether it's a civil rights question, a consumer rights question, whether it's a health care debate, the financial debacle on Wall Street, whatever it may be. People can see the links that are drawn when we are not controlling our government, we're not controlling our democracy. And that local organizing that can take place all around this country is what's going to build this movement to build it to an amendment that comes out of Congress.
Well, I wish you the very best in your efforts, and I laud them and applaud them. And here at the Horn, whatever we can do to help you advance this laudable goal, we will do everything in our power to.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Because it's the seminal political issue in terms of political the mechanics of politics.
Absolutely.
That we face right now.
It really is.
We screw this one up, everything goes sideways.
I mean, you know, our democracy is really in jeopardy here, and that's why we're here talking about this, and why we demand that we rise up together and change it.
Well, thank you, John Bonifaz. I really appreciate
thank
it.
You.
Best
thank you so
of luck.
Much. Thank you.
John Bonifaz, the legal director of Voter Action and the director of Free Speech for People. Again, that website, go have a look. I think you're going to find yourself quite interested. Go have a look, freespeechforpeople.org. This is an overt attempt to fix what John Roberts, Samuel Alito, well, you know what we call them. They're the rats, Roberts, Alito, Thomas, and Scalia. This is an overt attempt to fix what they screwed up and save this country's political structure before it can be broken all asunder, like the chorus says in the end of Henry V. I tell you what we're going to do, right quick. I'm going to, don't anybody panic, I'm going to kill the stream. And we'll go to some Glockenspiel music for a minute. And then I will be back in a few minutes after after I attend to a couple of things. You are listening to live continuing coverage of the America's Future Now conference taking place at the Omni Shoreham Hotel, brought to you by the Campaign for America's Future, and brought to you in part also this portion of the horn portion of the broadcast, brought to you by the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and coalriverwind.org. Like I said, I'm going to kill the stream for a minute. I'll be back in a couple, and we will finish out the day's broadcast on my portion with a conversation with Bob Borisage, the co-founder and co-director of the Campaign for America's Future. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn. And we are back at the America's Future Now conference at the Omni Shoreham Hotel in Washington, D.C., live on The Horn both today and tomorrow. I am joined right now by one of the individuals, well, more than any other reason, for the existence of the America's Future Now conference. Bob Borisage is with me. He is the co-director of the Campaign for America's Future, the host of this conference. Bob, thanks for taking a few minutes to join us.
My pleasure.
This is how many years now?
It's been quite a few. It's been about six, I think, since it exploded.
Wow.
And got big.
Well, this is I think, my third, and it is an amazing event that brings together so many people of such goodwill, such passion, and such determination to see real progress forward in what not only what America is, but what America can be, and CFA is such a vital and dynamic part of all of that.
I think this recovery is in trouble. We think you can't accept 24 million people unemployed or underemployed as a routine condition, and that we need real action out of the Congress to put people back to work as the first priority in both in terms of sustaining the recovery and getting the economy moving, but also just avoiding the devastation that comes from long-term unemployment. You know, the divorces, the child neglect, the homelessness, the misery, the loss of homes, the loss of futures. We have to take action now and treat this as an emergency, not as something that we just accept.
And I'm glad that you mentioned the sequelae that goes with unemployment, because it's very easy, especially in this town, to see and hear the debate limited to the question of will we extend unemployment benefits, and the other side is very good at being very mean-spirited about all that. If we extend the unemployment benefits, then they won't want to go back to work. Apparently, none of those people on that side have ever tried to exist on unemployment benefits because it is not a life of leisure.
And you've got six people applying for every job,
right?
That's out there. You do put up a job announcement, and 3,000 people show up in this city.
Realistically, though, I've read a lot of numbers that say that while the official numbers say that unemployment is at 9.7%. That realistically it's closer to 17, and in the worst of it all, approaching 20. Is there truth in that?
Oh, yeah, there's no question. If you count unemployed, underemployed, that is people forced to work part-time because they can't find a full-time job, the people who've given up, you're talking about 24, 25 million people. You're talking about 20%, 21% depression-level unemployment. And then when you look at subcategories, we have the worst teenage unemployment since they started keeping figures. For young people, and now increasingly for people over 55 who get laid off, they really can't find a way back into this workforce.
It's over at that point, the way it is now, as far as finding meaningful employment. What is the ripple effect of unemployment numbers like that? I mean, if that's what it is today, the 17% realistically, if that's what it is today, what does that mean for America 2, 3, 4 years from now?
Well, when you have this kind of long-term unemployment, a couple things happen. One is people lose skills. Lives really do get crushed, and so it gets harder and harder to reemploy folks. The second thing is, needless to say, you have the social impact of a generation of young people that doesn't start their careers, and so starts in the hole, and that leads to increased drug use, it leads to increased crime, it leads to increased depression and hopelessness, and there's a huge set of social costs. In the macro kind of economic sense, you can't, you know, officially the economists say the economy is recovering because it started to show growth. But you can't have a recovery when you have 20 million people unemployed.
Yeah, that's that contradiction in terms that I keep hearing people raise considerable concern about, the notion of a jobless recovery. That's no recovery at all, is it?
Right, and then at that level of unemployment affects the people who are employed. That is, it puts huge downward pressure on wages. There's no way you're getting wage increases other than voluntary ones from your employer, because there's such a supply of workers.
And then the people who do have jobs are getting worked into the ground,
yeah,
aren't they?
Exactly.
Because they don't have adequate support around them.
And they can't, and they're caught, because you can't leave your job at this point. Your employer knows it.
Is there from your perspective, is there a magic bullet solution out there? Is there one thing that the Obama administration should be doing that isn't being done? Is there something the Congress should be doing that they're not doing that would provide a real and meaningful and immediate solution?
Well, I believe that the problem we have is the recovery plan, which was the biggest in history, was too small, and that it should have been another $400 billion in investment, particularly in building infrastructure, in direct public service jobs with urban cores and rural cores for young people. We should be creating right now a coastal conservation corps to clean up the coasts.
So really Rooseveltian
Put people to work. I think particularly when you have this kind of financial collapse, when people have lost $5 trillion in savings and they're starting to rebuild their savings, when you've lost this kind of loss in housing values, these kinds of foreclosures, you're not going to get consumption and the private economy to drive this recovery until you really put people to work and give them a chance to have real resources again. So I think we made a mistake, understandable mistake, about how small the recovery plan was. I think conservatives who say it was too big got it wrong. The political pundits who say people are worried about deficits, you can't do the spending, I think they got it wrong too. I think if the deficits were twice as big as they are now and people were working, they'd still be worried about the deficit, but they'd be a lot happier.
And oddly enough, I have a hard time taking the deficit people very seriously when, especially on the right wing side of things, they were as quiet as the tomb for 8 years. While the previous occupant of the White House drove deficits through the roof.
At a time when the economy was growing and there was no reason to do it, and did it by waging wars without paying for them and doing benefits without paying for them and then cutting taxes on the top end. And what you don't hear from any of those deficit folks that are concerned now is talking about raising the taxes on the top end again or paying for the wars.
Well, one of the things that also disturbs me from our side, though, Bob, is the fact that President Obama has some of those very deficit people out there, the deficit hawks, who are casting rather wolfish eyes at things like Social Security, at things like Medicare. Do you have a sense that he sees any of that stuff as a real solution?
Well, you know, during the campaign, when he talked about this, he was almost spot on. That is, he said correctly, Social Security is not a problem. The real problem in long-term debt and deficits is entirely the soaring cost of medical care. If you fix, and it's not Medicare, it's medical care, the health care system that's broken. If you fix the health care system, we don't have a long-term debt problem in this country. If you don't fix the health care system, you can't fix the debt problem any other way. And so you've got to be focused on that. But we have this, what's happened is, You have this political concern about deficits. The president deciding that he's going to reassure prematurely, in my view, people about deficits, setting up this commission to look at it. The commission says, well, we've just done health care reform, so we're not going to pay attention to health care, which is the problem. So we have to show people we're serious. We'll fix Social Security, which doesn't need fixing. And then they say, We're going to put a three-year freeze on domestic spending, where we had this massive domestic investment deficit in everything from 21st century infrastructure to clean water to education and training, and a military budget that's as big as the rest of the world's combined, and that's off the table and still going up.
When you described a couple of months ago, you described deficit as the political concern about the deficit. That I take your words to mean that you say that as distinguished from a real world economic or accounting concern about the deficit. Is there an element of this deficit concern that really is generated for political purposes or purposes I would consider less pure than actual concern about the well-being of the nation?
Well, bankers and investors and creditors always are concerned about anything that will reduce the value of the dollar and reduce the value of the debts they are owed, and so they worry about inflation even though they can't see any. This country verges on deflation. We have declining prices. And that's a much bigger problem than any kind of distant sense of inflation. But if you're out of Wall Street or you're a creditor, you're worried about the distant sense of inflation. So they campaign, guys like Pete Peterson, the billionaire Wall Street guy.
He drives me crazy.
Who's been behind this campaign on deficits. He campaigns about it when the economy's up, when it's down. It doesn't, he's got a one note and he's focused on Social Security and Medicare.
And I guess what I'm asking, isn't that because he comes from a political psychic space, if you will, that despises the very idea of Social Security?
It could be that he's part of that conservative tribe that's against it completely. Certainly he campaigns against it viciously. And the reality is Wall Street just blew up this economy. In the depression that followed, the recession that followed, we doubled our national debt, right, essentially. That was because of the Wall Street follies. So now these guys who are paying themselves million-dollar bonuses want to turn and say to people on Social Security, well, we got to tighten our belts now. You're going to have to take the hit. Let's start by having the bankers pay some money, having the wealthy pay some taxes on the rich, and let's secure Social Security when people have just lost all their savings in the crisis that the bankers caused with their follies.
And yet we have a hard time messaging on that very thing, it would seem, Bob, because the guy working his job living in small town America didn't create the Wall Street bubble, didn't create the housing bubble, didn't create the credit default swaps and derivatives. And yet it would seem that the right wing sees as the only solution to the problem those guys on Wall Street created is to soak me.
Yep.
How do we change that dynamic or the tone of that message?
People have just got to, think about it and think it through, and we got to argue our case. I do think we have this metaphor gap. the metaphor of, well, when things are tough in the family, we tighten our belt, so government ought to do the same thing. Or we balance our checkbook at the end of every month, so government ought to do the same thing. Those are very powerful metaphors. They make sense. It just kind of follows that's the way we ought to be operating. And, in fact, they are economically very counterproductive. When the private sector is tightening its belt, we want government to take on deficits and to create demand and to get people hired and to create jobs and to keep the economy moving. Otherwise, if we all tighten our belts at once because we've just lost a lot of savings, this economy is going through the floor, and then we'll all be in trouble. That's kind of basic Keynesian economics. It's a basic thing we learned in the 30s. But it is counterintuitive to those metaphors, and we don't really have a good metaphor on our side that counters it.
We're not good at bumper stickers at all on our side, are we? I'm very much concerned with what does happen to small town America, because there are big manifestations of problems and there are little manifestations of problems, but they wind up going to the same place. The anti-tax crowd, the Grover Norquists of the world, campaigned their fool heads off for a generation on the notion that a people who pays for what it wants via taxation is somehow being abused. Well, now Colorado Springs can't mow its grass. Now towns in California are closing their parks because they literally can't afford to have the garbage emptied, and they've nailed the restroom doors shut in their public spaces. Is there a way back from that brink, or is the other side winning incrementally just by slowly taking one more thing away every day?
Well, I think there's no question in this crisis that real services are getting cut. I mean, we're talking about 350,000 teachers across the country getting laid off next year. Chicago's talking about going to public school, grade school classes that are 41 kids. You know, at that point, you're not teaching anybody. You're just warehousing them.
Right.
So they're closing summer schools in major cities across the country, which is catastrophic for young kids. So, I think real services are getting cut. I think middle-class kids feel it when they try to go to college because the tuitions are just soaring as the state reduces its contribution to public universities. And the question is, will people eventually decide that they're push back on it? In Oregon, where they faced real cuts in the school system, they managed to go to a referendum that increased corporate taxes, increased taxes on the top end, in order to keep schools, you know, teachers employed and public services going. And it was a close battle. The right wing came in big with a lot of money. Corporations weighed in big. But they managed to win that, making the argument that that's the kind of community they wanted to build. You know, America came out of World War II in great debt, 120% of GDP, higher than it is now. And we sent an entire generation to college or training with the GI Bill. We built the interstate highways. We rebuilt Europe and created markets for our goods. We provided conversion monies to convert military factories to civilian factories, and we created the economy that built the great American middle class. That is the great success story of our country. We're at that kind of turning point now. We have come out of the worst recession since the Great Depression. We've got significant debt, not nearly as much as after World War II, and we've got to build a new economy. And if we don't do it, if we don't make those investments, if the Grover Norquists starve us of resources and starve us of will, we're not going to see the middle class that we were accustomed to over the last years.
That, as a grandfather, that frightens me.
That's very frightening.
And yet it was kind of wild, I guess it was last week or so, that Secretary of State Clinton made the observation that Brazil has the highest ratio of tax to GDP, and they're the ones who are growing like crazy while we're still sitting out here trying to figure out if we're going to let the deficit be our bete noire. I guess for everyone, for you, for philosophically speaking, in terms of what CFA does, this really is a sort of a crossroads, isn't it? This is the moment where we decide what kind of an America we're going to have. When you press the issues that you bring to the table, economic issues, jobs issues, is there, you were talking about conservation corps and things like that. Is there a Marshall Plan kind of thing out there, though? Is it the green energy revolution that we hear so much about? Is there one place that we can start and get it right and go forward and know that we can fix the rest by virtue of the fact that we fixed one?
That's a good question. I think the president broadly has put the question to Americans quite well. He's argued, look, you can't recover to the old economy. And you shouldn't want to. That economy didn't work when it was supposed to be growing under Bush. We had the middle class lost income over the course of that decade. They lost ground. We had greater inequality.
Wage stagnation since 1970 for all intents.
We had the buildup of massive debt in the middle class. We had the buildup of massive debt in the country as we ran these great trade deficits. You can't go back there. So what he argues is you've got to build a new foundation, which is you start by investing in educating the next generation, in R&D for to create the next generation of innovation in new energy so that we get off our addiction to oil and reduce our trade deficits and deal with global warming and capture a lead role in the Industrial Revolution, which must sweep the world, and then build a 21st century infrastructure that works. When you do that, you've got to have progressive taxation to pay for it. You've got to shrink the financial sector so it's not capturing 40% of the corporate profits. And you've got to balance trade so that we're not simply buying all the goods from China and borrowing the money from them to do it and go deeper and deeper in debt. That's what he's laid out in the Georgetown speech and elsewhere. And the problem is that all of the inertial forces of a society would take you back to that old economy instead of the new one. So the conservatives oppose the investments, and the Congress hasn't put up the money to do them. The new energy stuff, we don't have an industrial policy, so the new energy money we're spending... It's going to get it is being captured by China and Germany and Spain that are taking the lead in windmills and solar, et cetera, because they do have an industrial policy. Trade deficits back up to $1 billion a day and rising. And the corporate, the financial profits are back up to 30% of corporate profits.
What does it take
rising.
To get the Obama administration serious about an industrial policy, Bob?
Well, that one's still, that's going to have to happen to them because I can tell you, Larry Summers, that's the bet noir of Larry Summers. He doesn't believe in it. He doesn't want the words used in the administration. He sort of outlawed the language, much less the thinking around it.
That's astonishing because I don't understand how you rebuild without it. I sincerely don't.
Well, and what happens is we saw that story of the windmill where you had stimulus plan money for new energy, go to a windmill operation in park in Texas, and 85% of the jobs were going to be created in China. We were just going to assemble the windmills at the end of the day in Texas and then manage the windmill park. If you had a Buy America, any sense of building a supply side, any industrial policy that says we're going to take windmills and solar and new energy, we're going to capture a lead role in this, and we're going to do what we need to do to keep those jobs here and build the skills, et cetera, every international company will come here. All you got to do is tell them you got to build the jobs here. They'll
here. That was one of the untold stories that came out of the Upper Big Branch mine disaster in West Virginia where I live. Everyone kept talking about coal as a function of electricity production. Very few people managed to note that the mine that blew up was a metallurgical coal mine. It was a mine whose sole purpose was to produce metallurgical-grade coal that was then being put on a train, taken to a boat in Virginia, put on the boat in Virginia, and sent to China.
Amazing.
And, that's a finite resource, and I'm very conscious of coal-related issues, especially mountaintop removal coal being used for electricity generation because it's, 3.5 million pounds of high explosives a day used on my state alone. That's a Hiroshima every 9 days. But in terms of the finite resources of metallurgical-grade coal, it's mind-blowing to me that you talk about a lack of an industrial policy. It's mind-blowing to me that we allow these critical reserves that would be used as a necessary component of a reinvigorated steel industry, for instance. If we get to that day where we say, gosh, it sure would be nice to reinvigorate the steel industry, and we look up and suddenly realize that Don Blankenship sent all the metallurgical coal to China, well, what kind of a hole are we in then?
Yeah, and the problem is, we have this kind of ideological belief in free trade, but half the world is mercantilist. The world, like China, is controlling resources and planning its economy. We don't have to imitate them, but we have to have our own strategy to deal with them.
Exactly.
And to ignore it and to pretend that the whole world's playing by the same set of rules is simply folly.
It absolutely is. Bob Borisaj, I've enjoyed our conversation immensely. I hope we'll have another one in the future. Best to all that you and the entire staff at the Campaign for America's Future do and continue to do and the magnificence of this whole event. Thank you very, very kindly,
sir. My pleasure. Good to see you here.
It's a pleasure.
Thank you. It really is.
Bob Borisaj, co-director, Campaign for America's Future, with economic observations that I think we ignore at our peril. And so that's going to wrap up my portion of the program for today. Coming up, three rock-solid hours with Rick Smith. Jake, you going to join in on this too? Or are you just going to sit there and smile? Oh, there's a lot, just like going on a remote down at the car lot. Oh, there's a lot going on down here. We will go to Rick here in a couple of minutes. So I'm going to shut down for now and thank you all for joining in. Remind you that we will be back here at the same bat time, same bat channel tomorrow, noon Eastern Daylight Time, live from the Omni Shoreham Hotel in a sunny and exquisite Washington, D.C. I'm looking out at the hotel pool, and I want to run and jump into it right now. Coming up, Rick Smith, The Rick Smith Show for you live. He's got a great lineup of guests, and I'm sure you will enjoy every bit of it. So thanks, everybody. We'll talk to you tomorrow.